Brian Noonan is playing on the radio, baby.
You know, I have found in my travels that all the best things in life happen after 2 a.m. Because after 2 a.m. is when things get, audience, say it with me, legendary.
Holy s***! Brian's back!
Brian is the best. I love Brian Noonan. He's super funny and he's just got tons of energy, and he's just a terrific guy. So listen to Brian on Sunday nights because he does a really good show.
Well, it's the big show. Yes, it's a big, bad show tonight.
Good morning. Welcome. Glad you're with me. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio this week on 720 WGN. Nick is taking a well-deserved vacation after his weekend at Fear Fest or Scare Fest or whatever scary movie fest Nick was at. I kept seeing the pictures of him with different horror people, and I thought, man, oh man, that's everybody. That's what I love. Everybody's got their niche. Nick was out with horror movie people. Thousands and thousands of people were sweating in Grant Park for Lollapalooza, and then Esmeralda, Vic, and I, and Dan, we're here. That's always nice. Hello, Vic. Hello, Esmeralda. How are you?
Doing good.
How you doing?
I am well. It's good to see you guys. It'll be a fun week. I'm looking forward to it. Love it. I got to say a happy 6th anniversary to the fine producer Dan Chagrou and his lovely wife Eileen. They celebrated their anniversary yesterday.
Why, thank you.
I saw the it came up on a number of Facebook things, and I saw, obviously, Eileen posted something on Facebook. And then my Facebook memory was my wife and I at the in the little photo booth thing that you guys had with the crazy props where you do the whole thing. It was so that was a fun way.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it was 6 years though.
I can't believe it's 6 years.
I was like, holy cow, what has where has time gone? So there, congratulations.
Do you still own the seersucker suit you wore?
I actually, I have a seersucker suit. That one that I wore to that wedding, I mistakenly gave away because I got too small for it. I shrunk and the suit stayed big. I should have kept the bigger suit. Then I got a smaller seersucker and, you know. But yes, I still wear a seersucker. That was the first time I wore a bow tie. To an event was your wedding, based on my wife's recommendation and telling me out of the blue how attractive she found men in bow ties.
Mm.
Yeah, which was, you know, that's something I know, Esmeralda. I was as shocked as you are. I was going to get a shirt and tie for Dan's wedding, and I had just gotten this seersucker suit. And my wife, there was a mannequin, a couple mannequins. This was 6 years ago. Bow ties were just coming back in fashion. And my wife said, oh, man, I think that looks great. I love bow ties. Well, you know, from then on, Daddy's not wearing anything but bow ties.
Do you wear bow ties with your T-shirts?
No, I'm not.
Just because you're like, hey.
That's all I wear around the house, a bow tie and some spats. Just wander around. How you doing? Yeah, I'm Mr. Peanut. Come here. Want to get salty? She flees now. She rues the day she ever gets. That's why I get no more compliments. Ever, because she knows I will take the most simple compliment and turn it into a lifelong nightmare. So now I still wear bow ties all the time though. People comment. I was at an event last Friday and I had a bow tie on. You would have thought I came in on fire. People are shocked, and I don't think. I mean, I think you got to wear. You're wearing a tie anyway. Everybody's wearing. A long tie, you set yourself apart a little bit. Then people are, do you tie it yourself? I go, of course, of course you tie it yourself. If you're going to wear a bow tie, you have to know how to tie it. That way, you can go Rat Pack at the end of the night. Because you untie the bow tie, you unbutton the first couple buttons of the tux shirt, and the bow tie just hangs there, and suddenly you're like Sinatra. Only without the talent, the mob connections, or the millions of dollars. But you're just like him if you could sing, which you try to do during karaoke. But that's that. Are you a Lollapalooza person, Lollapalooza person, Esmeralda? Did you Lollapalooze?
No.
How about you, Vic? I know Vic is busy working on the news.
No, maybe 20 years ago.
I won't bother you anymore. Vic's like, come on, I got news to write. I called
Vic, but Vic will own up to this. Vic was like a bystander Lollapalooza because he's so close to it, his apartment.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
You know what? I escaped, Dan, for the weekend. I went out to the suburbs and got a hotel.
Did you really?
I did.
You fled your home?
I did. It was too loud.
It makes sense.
I mean, everybody criticized me too. You know, I got a ton of get off my lawn text messages.
That's hilarious. I'm leaving town. When I lived out in Frankfurt, people would do that. They have the big fall fest. People would do it, so I don't blame you. You don't want to be... Listen, there's a lot of dirty hippies running around, Vic. They might be outside your building smelling a patchouli oil and what God knows what else.
I saw them just now. I went out to grab some food over at the market around the corner.
Yeah.
And they're just everywhere without shirts on.
Yeah, my park...
shirtless. Too much.
You guys, I live right across the park that's behind this building that we work in. So all I have to do is cross the park to get here, and it kind of looked... It looked a little bit like like a refugee camp, a little bit. I'm not kidding.
Well, I ran out earlier because I did my regular show earlier, and I walked out, like Esmeralda said, and I could hear it in the distance. So I feel I was at Lollapalooza because I heard it off in the distance, like thunder. All I could make out was boom, 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 like bass and rumblings. It. But I don't blame you for getting out of here, Vic. I'd take off, too. First off, every year I think to myself, this is the year I'm going to Lollapalooza. I'm going to go one. And I look at the lineup, and I find a day, and I go, oh, I know four of these 200 bands, so I'll probably fit in. Then I realize I'm way too old. I don't have nearly enough ink to go. Besides doing a bag check and other security things, you have to have a tattoo, right? Because everybody I saw walking away from Lollapalooza had tattoos.
No, I think you have to have a headband and some...
glitter.
Aviator sunglasses. That's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah, and glitter.
I could do
everywhere.
Those three. I could glitter up. Just glitter in a bow tie. How's that for a Lollapalooza
Esmeralda?
Oh, man. I'd be like the Timothy Leary of 2019 next year. Just wandering around. People coming up trying to lick the glitter off me like they're deer. And I'm just made of salt. Be unbelievable. Maybe next year. No, if I did last, was it last year that Eminem was there, or 2 years ago? That was the year I was going to pull the trigger, and then I realized I'm a man over 50. I don't need to be standing in a mosh pit with a bunch of bros trying to watch Eminem.
Why you got to get VIP.
Well, sure, but that's true. I could be one of those. I'm too good to mingle with the masses.
Hey, man, you're press. You can get in with a press pass.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I always think of that after, or when somebody like you tells me that after. Well, that doesn't do me any good now for next year. Yeah, because the press people get to go in like an air-conditioned tent, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Fake media,
they get
fake
food.
Music fans. Yeah, see? They're not even real music fans. Just hanging out, pretending. Would I get to play ping pong? I saw that was a big thing at Lollapalooza this year.
Yeah, I saw some pictures, too.
People playing ping pong, mm-hmm. eating lobster corn dogs. That's really... I'm going to be honest, because I don't know any of the bands, really. I would just go for the lobster corn dog.
Oh, I go to Pitchfork every year, and I usually don't know anybody.
Yeah? Do you have fun?
I just wander around. Yeah. Well, I have a VIP pass as well, so...
Oh, see? All right. That's how...
That's how you have to do it, because then you're very comfortable.
That's what I need. I need comfort, because the masses bother me.
Yeah, no, ditto. That's why I don't go if it's not VIP. I know that sounds so snobby.
it
sounds crazy snobby, but it's the thing
great.
Is, like, I'm comfortable then. I can find shade somewhere in a toilet that hasn't been just, like, obliterated.
Oh, yeah. It's, especially for a lady, that's a big deal.
Those are really the only things I need.
I will be honest with you, Esmeralda. I understand that 1,000%. If I can go to a sporting event or anything like that, as in a VIP capacity where I have access to a bathroom that most of the other people can't get to, and I can stand where I'm not smashed in a crowd. Oh, I'm there, 100%. Well, I got to call Perry Farrell then for next year. Dan, can you get me that number, can't you?
Yep,
get me
Perry's
number so I can call him and set that up. They already released the dates for next year. It's again the first weekend in August. No big thunderstorms this year. I was always, because usually Lollapalooza means there's going to be one horrific torrential storm day where all the glitter will be rinsed off all the concert goers. But that didn't happen this year. Good for them. All the body paint got to stick. All right, listen. Maybe you didn't know any of the bands at Lollapalooza, but I guarantee you, you know the Beatles. And a man who knows more about the Beatles, pretty much more than even the Beatles, I'm going to guess, at this point. Robert Rodriguez is going to join us afterwards. There's a big fest for Beatles fans this weekend, so we're going to talk the Beatles. If you have any questions, 312-981-7200, that's the phone, that's the text when you call in and you talk to Dan. Wish him a happy anniversary, and of course, be nice to him. That way you get to me. We'll do all of that and so much more after this. WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick. Nick's on vacation this week. I will be keeping you company until 5 o'clock. That, of course, the Beatles' day in the life. Everybody knows the Beatles. It's said that the people fall into two camps, the Stones or the Beatles. A lot of people straddle both. I am a fan of the Beatles, but there is probably no bigger fan than our guest. Robert Rodriguez is the author of 5 books on the Beatles. He will be hanging around at the Fest for Beatles Fans this weekend, August 10th through the 12th at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. Robert also hosts a podcast. You've heard him with Nick before, and I'm happy to say hello, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brian. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thanks for staying up late with us. Now, I know you've talked to Nick in the past, but this is our first conversation, so I have to ask the obvious question for a man who's put so much effort and passion into following one group. How did you get involved? How did you get interested in the Beatles? And what is it about them that made you decide this is going to be my life's work?
Well, you fall into things, and you don't actually, I don't think anybody makes a career choice if I'm going to follow the Beatles. There might be a few people, but it wasn't my case. It was just one door opened into another. And I became a fan in the 70s after they'd split. I had older brothers that were into their records, and so they were sort of in past tense already, kind of, sort of, by the time I started getting into them and their history. You know, they already had come and gone. Mm-hmm. There was nothing less cool than being a Beatle fan in the 70s. When Led Zeppelin ruled and Kiss and Rush and all that stuff. So it was kind of going against the tide. But I think ultimately, once you get to the music and you get through every album and maybe you start absorbing the films, you start reading everything you can, the thing is, as a history geek, there is so much to learn. There are so many stories. You know, you've got the tide of myth fighting the tide of, well, the actual history. And to me, the actual history is way more fascinating than the stuff that they put out or that other people have sort of promoted as, you know, the Beatles story. There's so much to learn that even now things are being dug up and new things are coming to light. So it's just a story that is endlessly fascinating, and there's always something to learn from it.
What are some of the biggest myths that people have about the Beatles that through all your research these are all overblown? Maybe there was a kernel of truth to them at some point, or maybe they were completely fabricated.
Well, there was the stories themselves that, you know, when I started writing my books, my first one came out in 2007, and inevitably, with every book I write, I get asked, did you interview Paul? Did you interview Ringo? And I always say no, because I really have no interest in talking to those guys now as far as researching things that happened 50 years ago happens to be, because whatever memories they have, they were in the eye of the hurricane. They were doing their job. They weren't keeping track of stuff. That's for other people to do. And so a lot of what they believe to be true is completely off base or not supported by the facts. You know, I mean, if I was asking you, you know, what did you do at your job 10 years ago this month? You know, I'm sure unless we examine the records, what you remember might be at great variance, and so it is with them. You know, one of the stories, Paul, to this day, even though he must surely know better by now, he talks about when they first came to America in 64 to do the Ed Sullivan shows in February 64, he said that they had this trepidation because no British pop act had made it in America before, and so they were going to only come over once they had a number one hit record in America. And sure enough, when they landed in JFK Airport February 7, 64, the number one record in America was I Want to Hold Your Hand. The problem with that story is they were booked in November of 1963 before they had a hit record of any any kind in America. They were booked purely on the basis that, number one, Brian Epstein, their manager, forced the issue to try to get them an American foothold on national television. And two, Ed Sullivan, you know, his story is that he saw the crowds screaming, amassing at Heathrow Airport. There's more evidence that it was one of his underlings that actually saw the crowds. But he was intrigued without even hearing a note of their music by the fact that, one, they were drawing all this hysteria, two, that they'd played before the Royals, and three, they had the funny haircuts. That was the strength of his interest in booking them. He didn't hear a note of their music. It didn't matter to him. They were novelty. Yeah, just like a few plate spinners on his show. You know, it didn't matter.
It makes sense. Robert Rodriguez is my guest. He has written 5 books about the Beatles. If you go to revolverbook.com, you can see all about them. We'll talk more about the books, the Beatles. We'll talk a little bit about the Fest for Beatles Fans, which is coming up, and an appearance that Robert will be making on Monday the 13th after the Fest. So a lot to get to as we talk all about the Beatles. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. That's the phone and the text number. Robert, hold on. We'll do this, and we will talk some more right after this on 720 WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, and we are talking all things Beatles with our guest Robert Rodriguez, the author of 5 books on the Beatles, starting with The Fab Four Fact, and the latest book, was The Beatles Solo in the 70s, John, Paul, George, Ringo, 1970 to 1980. Robert, welcome back. Thanks for hanging around. Now, you were just also in Esquire magazine for an article that was how the Beatles recorded one of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time, which you say is Revolver. And your book, you wrote one of your third book was Revolver, How the Beatles Reimagined Rock and Roll. Now, a lot of people will say, hey, listen, Robert, everybody knows that Sgt. Pepper's is the greatest Beatles album, and you beg to differ. You say, no, you are wildly incorrect. What makes Revolver the best Beatles album?
Well, here's the thing. I wouldn't tell people that they should believe that it should be their favorite Beatles album. You know, I'm not going to impose opinions on people.
Okay.
But what I would say is that it is, on the one hand, Pepper, its biggest impact was sort of sociological and as far as really getting the establishment validation that rock and roll was capable of producing art. It sort of changed the paradigm for the way people thought of the rock and roll currency from the hit single to an album-length statement. So it had all those things going for it. Mm-hmm. But as a collection of songs, as a fully invested Beatle product, not so much compared to Revolver, which is really, I make the case of it being the high water mark of them as the four-headed monster, as Mick Jagger called them, all four pulling in the same direction, on the same page artistically, and really pushing the boundaries all at once. You see a unity there. I mean, just for the fact that the junior partner of the Beatles, George Harrison, gets not only 3 original compositions on the album, a ratio he never again equaled, right, but also the lead-off track on the album. And there are any number of songs on the album you can point to where they're clearly group collaborations. Even something like Eleanor Rigby, as much as you associate it with Paul, had some major contributions lyrically from George and Ringo and from John Lennon's best friend, Pete Shaw. So there was this real collaborative atmosphere that you never really saw again with the Beatles. And with Pepper, a lot of it was driven by Paul McCartney and George Martin working together. George had sort of stepped away from the Beatles by that time. He was immersed in Eastern philosophy and Indian music, barely touched his guitar that year. Every song that he wrote, they recorded in 67. He wrote on keyboard.
Okay.
Ringo described Pepper as, that was the time I learned how to play chess in the studio, sitting around on a call, basically. And John was largely enthralled to acid that year. And yes, he came up with some good songs, but it was not the same John who had so dominated in the early years. Here he had more to be sort of pushed into contributing to the album. And so it really wasn't the full-blown Beatle collaboration that you saw the year before with Revolver. And Revolver got so overshadowed because it was so experimental, so different, so all over the map. The same week it was released, which was, you know, 52 years ago today,
right,
in England, they went out on tour, starting in Chicago, for their final tour in America, didn't play a single song from it, as if it didn't exist. And all people wanted to talk about when they were giving their press conferences was, so John, what did you mean when you said the Beatles were more popular than Jesus? Completely knocked-off message. So
yeah,
it didn't get the attention it deserved in '66, but the world was ready a year later when Pepper came.
Well, and it's funny because you say you think about a band going on tour and not playing songs from an album that included Taxman, Eleanor Rigby, Yellow Submarine, Good Day Sunshine, and so many more. Where you would think, boy, that you go out, you play every song off that album.
Yeah, I mean, and even if you want to discard the ones that are such products of the studio with production and strings and tape loops and all that, just the guitar-driven ones they could play on stage, the will wasn't there anymore. They really saw themselves at that point at a crossroads wearing two different hats. The tours were this sort of obligation, as Lennon called them, bloody tribal rights, where the audiences couldn't hear them, they couldn't hear each other, and they had nothing to do with music.
Right.
And so, really, it's like once the obligations were out of the way, they recognize midway through that tour, what are we doing this for? You know, our heart is so not in this. The most recent song they did was recorded during the Revolver sessions, which is Paperback Writer. You listen to the tapes of it on that tour, and it's a guitar-driven song, which there's a lot of harmonies on it. You just couldn't do a decent version of it live, and it was just a band going through the motions on that last tour.
So Revolver is where they really started doing more and more work in the studio, and it took, I think I read in one of your 300 hours of production on Revolver, is that correct?
It sounds more like Pepper, but it was a big amount of time only because as you look at their career, in 64 they did a film, in 65 they did a film. 66 they were supposed to do the third film of their contract, United Artists, but they could not agree on a script. And they didn't know what they were going to be writing songs for. So once it reached the point where they're past deadline, it's like, well, I guess we're not doing a film this year. They had this amount of time blocked out that they were expecting to be filming that they can now use this bounty of available time to work on an album. And so if you look at the way they approached the Revolver sessions, the very first song they record, Tomorrow Never Knows, you know, this it's the finale track to the album, but it's just replete with all kinds of tape loops and things turned backwards and sped up. It's clear that they were throwing away everything they knew on how to make records and just creating sounds that only exist inside the four studio walls. So that was a major leap. You know, they'd been incrementally dabbling in it as far back as Help, where they're using strings for the first time, and Yesterday. Rubber Soul, they've got sitar, they've got the sped-up piano solo in My Life that sounds like a harpsichord. You know, there's different things they're doing, you know, taking baby steps into creating sounds that they knew they couldn't pull off live. And then they just go full tilt with Revolver. So that's where they're really, subconsciously or consciously, making the decision, we're going to be a studio band. You know, to hell with this going out on their own and being our own tribute act. You know, that was a dead end for them. At the same time, they're taking this big, huge risk because, number one, they don't know if their audience is going to stay with them. You know, maybe they like the sort of Herman's Hermit side of the Beatles. You know, maybe they won't embrace this experimentation. But also, that was a big, lucrative income stream that they were making so much money in concerts, like the equivalent of $1 million just for the half hour they play at Shea, for instance, that, you know, they're taking an awful big risk by not playing live anymore, that the public's not going to follow them, and they're not going to be making the money that they're used to.
Is that a decision that all four of them make? Is that a decision that John and Paul make, and the other two have to go along with it? How does it come to a band that, you know, is finally, by the time Revolver, it's their seventh album, they're having great success, they're going out on the road. Who makes the call to say, you know what, we're not doing this anymore. We're just going to be in the studio. We're going to create our art in here, and that's the way it's going to be.
Well, part of their decision-making had been influenced by the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson. They were, you know, keeping tabs. They were label mates on Capitol, and they were certainly digesting the Beach Boys records as they came out. And there's a great quote from John Lennon in the fall of 1965 as the Beatles are starting work on Rubber Soul, where John is talking about the latest Beach Boys single called Little Girl I Once Knew. And Brian Wilson, who was really the creative spearhead of the Beach Boys, had retired from performing live by that time. So he's sitting in L.A. with the Wrecking Crew session guys crafting these great ornate, arranged, and produced backtracks for when the rest of the band comes in from the road and just lay down their vocals. They're not even needed instrumentally at that point. And John's listening to this, and he's like, look what Brian Wilson can do, just crafting all these sounds that are in his head when he's not beholden to the road. So that was sort of a tell where the Beatles were sort of thinking. So as far as which Beatle, I mean, George was probably the one that got the most sick of the whole thing first. I mean, he was a very, very serious musician. He recognized that playing live, and when they couldn't hear each other and their musicianship was starting to decay, was not a good thing. And, you know, John got pretty sick of it. Ringo got sick of it. And Paul was the last holdout. But halfway through that North American tour in 66, you know, there were so many things going wrong. You had, besides the Bigger Than Jesus controversy and radio stations, you know, not playing their records the way they used to. They're not selling out the stadiums as much. And there's the things like, you know, the KKK deciding they're going to picket them when they play Memphis. Somebody sets off a cherry bomb three songs into their set. And they're looking around to see which one of them had just been shot. And that was what it was like for them. They just recognized, this is pointless. What are we doing? And so it made an easy call by the end of that tour when they ended at Candlestick Park. Paul tells their press guy, tape record the show. And they knew that was going to be it for them.
Okay.
And when you weren't playing live anymore in 66, that was tantamount to saying you're retiring. Nobody knew you could sustain a career in rock and roll just with the records you put out and not appearing live anywhere.
Yeah, that's a brave and some would have, I'm sure, argued foolhardy step at that point. 312-981-7200, Robert Rodriguez is my guest. We're talking all about the Beatles. We will get into the Fest for Beatles Fans, which is happening this coming weekend, August 10th through the 12th at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. And then Robert will also be making a presentation, The Beatles in Chicago, on Monday, August 13th. At Mathers in Portage Park, which is 3235 North Central Avenue. All the details, of course, you can find at revolverbook.com. Let's take a real quick call, and then we'll take a break, because Carrie has been hanging on to talk to Robert. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Brian. Good to hear you.
Thank you. So what's your question for Robert?
Hey, Robert. First of all, Revolver, agree completely. Some of your comments. Paul... I recently saw a documentary where he actually said that he's not really, he doesn't really remember things like it was anymore, which is interesting, like you said. But here's my question for you. I've never heard a good definitive answer, and there's probably only two people in the world who know, but what happened with Pete Best? The best that we can know.
You mean as far as him being dismissed from the Beatles?
Yes.
Okay. It's very interesting you ask that question because there's a new book coming out. And as I alluded to at the beginning of the conversation with Brian, there are always new facts and new details and uncovered stuff to come out. And so it is with Pete Best. Now, for years, the story was, oh, he was so good-looking, the other Beatles were jealous, and they just kind of forced him out because they couldn't handle it. Yeah. And there's others that said, oh, well, he sucked as a drummer, you know. And it's certainly true. He was not as good as Ringo. I think one of the things that really convinced people in the years before Pete Best recordings for the Beatles were in wide circulation was when Anthology 1 came out, you heard his take of Love Me Do, where he shifts the drum pattern halfway through the song, and it just sounds god-awful. It's true that George Martin was not satisfied with him as a drummer in the studio. However, that was very common practice back then with beat groups, where you look at early records by the Kinks and other bands, they would spell one musician or another, sometimes the drummer, with studio pros just to make a good-sounding record. And it had nothing to do with replacing a member. There had been tensions, I think, with Brian and Pete Best's mother, who had been sort of acting as a de facto manager prior to Brian. He certainly didn't like her interference, and it was a factor that he was sort of chafing at. But with this new book coming out called Finding the Fourth Beatle by my good friend David Bedford, who is a Liverpudlian himself, he talked to a lawyer connected with Brian Epstein, and basically Pete was an adequate drummer for the Beatles, and in fact, they'd achieved their big stardom, such as it was in Liverpool and Hamburg, with him. You know, it was crude, it was heavy, but it was rock and roll. Could you make the argument that it was as good as what Ringo did in the studio? No, you really couldn't. It was two different kinds of drumming. But you couldn't say that he sucked outright. And basically, the case that David makes is that they took it from George Martin that they needed a studio-quality guy in the drummer's chair. And so they immediately started asking some studio pros. Ringo was like the fourth guy they asked. And he was the first one to say yes, because three other drummers turned him down. There's a lot of mythology like, well, you know, Ringo was a great friend of theirs and social. That's all true. But that wasn't the immediate thing they were going for. And basically, they had to let Pete know that they didn't want him in the group without firing him outright. Brian Epstein worked for the Beatles. So it was, he couldn't even fire that Pete if he wanted to, technically. But he had to make it known that the other guys were replacing him. And so Pete backed out of the group, taking it as a firing And that's really what kind of happened to ease him out of the group so that they could bring in somebody they thought would be able to push along their recording career. That's really what it came down to. There's other ancillary issues like the fact that he didn't get along with them as a personality. He wasn't as funny or as social. There was the fact that his best friend, Neil Aspinall, who was acting as the Beatles road manager back then, had impregnated Pete Best's mother, and that baby was delivered three weeks before they fired him or before he got eased out of the group. You know, imagine the scandal in Liverpool when they're getting ready on their recording career to find out that you know the drummer's mom got knocked up by the roadie. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. All this stuff it surfaces after the years. Yeah. You know, it's incredible. But you think you know the Beatles, man, and you really don't.
And then you don't care.
That's crazy. I thought I was going to get a short answer, but wow.
No.
But what you're telling me is there's not only one guy who could have been Ringo, but there's really four.
Yes, that's absolutely true. In fact, if you check out the podcast with David Bedford I did late last year, you'll hear the whole story from him.
Thank you.
The book
Gary.
Will be out at some point this
year. Thank you, man. Great. Great at your info. Thanks, Brian.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Gary.
Give us the name of the podcast, Robert.
Something About the Beatles.
It's on all
the podcast platforms, and it's at somethingaboutthebeatles.com.
Very nice. Robert Rodriguez is my guest. We'll take a quick break, and we've got a lot to talk about. 312-981-7200. If you have a question about the Beatles, get it. We'll talk about it here on WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick. We're talking Beatles with Robert Rodriguez, the author of 5 books on the Beatles. He is the host of Something About the Beatles podcast. You can go to revolverbook.com to get all the information. Robert, on Monday, August 13th, will be at Mathers in Portage Park giving a presentation, The Beatles in Chicago. That's at 12:30 in the afternoon. He'll also be hanging around the Fest for Beatles Fans, which is happening August 10th through the 12th at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. Thefest.com is the website to get all the information on that. Robert, Joe sent in a text, and he wanted to know, Leo Gorcey, he says, was taken off the Sgt. Pepper album cover because he wanted to be paid. I never heard how much money he wanted. Do you know? Do you know the legend of Leo Gorcey?
Yeah, being one of the Bowery Boys, Dead End Kids, he was, by 1967, kind of on hard times. And alone out of all the living celebrities that are in the Sgt. Pepper cover, he was the only one that asked for money up front. The amount of money he was asking for, I don't think has been documented, but I don't think it was very much, like 3 figures or less. And, you know, they were like, no, you know, why should we pay you and we're not paying Mae West?
Yeah, and so nobody got paid for being on that cover.
Right, and they did write personal letters to some of the living people just to get their permission wherever possible. I mean, it's kind of sweet the way they were doing things in 67.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they made the personal outreach, and I think it was Mae West that wanted to hear the record first, or she asked them, why would I be in a Lonely Hearts Club? And she won them over, and I guess that Mae West was so smitten with the whole experience that she recorded the version of Day Tripper.
Oh, very nice. Somebody else wanted to know, and you've kind of mentioned this before. They said, why don't Paul and Ringo ever tell the real Pete Best story? But as you kind of mentioned earlier, and you can elaborate on this, is it time distorts the real story?
I think so. I think that their impressions of their own history, a lot of it seems to be formed by the books and documentaries that, for better or worse, you know, accurately or non-accurately, tell what happened. You know, Paul goes around telling people that, oh, Stuart Sutcliffe, who was the fifth Beatle, who was the original bass player, was so bad at his instrument that he played with his back to the audience. Now, I'm sure everybody listening to this broadcast has seen a live band in a bar situation or something. If somebody sucks, it's not your eyeballs that are going to tell you that. It's your ears, okay?
Exactly, yes.
So turning your back is not going to make a damn bit of difference. Now, there are a couple pictures that show him with his back apparently turned, and the people who were there, who actually, you know, didn't have a pony in the fight, said, you know, he was probably trying to tune himself at that moment because that's something he took seriously.
Yeah.
Now, was he so terrible a bass player that he was unfit to be in the group? No, not really. He was, by people's accounts that were there, Klaus Voormann being especially noteworthy because he went on to be a fine session bass player himself, he said Pete was crude but a great rock and roll bass player that actually did well enough to hold his own at the time the Beatles were making all these fans in Hamburg. He only quit because he's more serious about art than he was about music, and he fell in love and he wanted to stay behind, and he didn't want to get in the group's way. But he wasn't this god-awful person. But this is the kind of stories that, you know, Paul in 64 was still describing Stewart as a decent bass player.
Yeah.
And over time, his story changed. And that's why, you know, talking to the Beatles now, I don't think you're going to get the straight story because, you know, and I don't blame them for not remembering it accurately. You know, one of the things you can point to is the Let It Be documentary, quote-unquote documentary. It's still not out on DVD, even though it's been ready to go for over a decade. Remastered, 5.1 sound, bonus disc and all that stuff. They won't pull the trigger on it. Why? Because I think they still have this perception in their heads that it was the most miserable, god-awful experience in their lives in the Beatles.
Really?
And that's certainly a big part of the impression you get from watching the movie. It doesn't show them in their best light. But as I said, so-called documentary, it doesn't document everything that happened because in some ways it was far better, in some ways it was far worse.
Yeah.
In the worst side, you don't get in Let It Be film the fact that, A, John was strung out on heroin for a lot of it, and, B, George Harrison quit the Beatles 10 days into the project. And you had to be talked back. You don't get that from watching the film. You see one little spat between him and Paul, but that's hardly the reason why he walked out. And on the other hand, you don't see all the great moments where they're really getting it together. And by the time they'd moved the sessions to Apple Studios, where they felt much more comfortable gearing up for the rooftop thing, what we know, because everything was taped and a lot of it was filmed, and you know, people like myself have access to that stuff, they were firing on all cylinders by the end of that project. In fact, John Lennon, of all people, was talking about taking the act live again,
which
is unbelievable. So you wouldn't know that from watching Let It Be film, and that's why I think that Paul and Ringo have such a negative perception of the whole thing. If they were to revisit what there is, what the Beatles scholars know,
yeah,
it would completely blow their minds.
All right, Robert Rodriguez is my guest. We are going to Robert's going to stay around through the news, and we're going to talk a little bit more because we have to talk about the fest. We haven't even mentioned that, and I have some other questions. If you have a question, 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break. Then it'll be news time, and then more with Robert Rodriguez talking all about the Beatles here on 720 WGN. He's the tax man. I'm the talk man. It's Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio. You like that one, didn't you, Dad? Nick is on vacation this week. I have the pleasure of being with you every morning from 1 until 5. And I have the extra pleasure this morning of talking to Robert Rodriguez. He is an Beatles expert, the author of 5 books, the host of the Something About the Beatles podcast. This is exciting. Tell us about Robert. You went to thanks for sticking around, by the way. People were getting a lot of great comments on the text, and people really learning a lot, which is exciting because you think you know. I mean, the Beatles have been around 50 years. We think we know everything we need to know about the Beatles, but you know, just talking to you so far, I've learned a bunch of cool stuff. So they like that. Now you went to Northwestern recently, and you got to see some manuscripts or some what kind of these documents that nobody else had seen.
Yeah, they've been there, I guess, since the 70s, but nobody has really had them out publicly until like the last 10 years or so ago. I first heard of them, I think it was around 2007, when there was a Tribune article about the existence of these 7 original handwritten Beatle lyric sheets.
Ooh.
And there 6 of them are from Revolver, which was good for me,
yeah,
and 1 for Rubber Soul. And they came from a donation from John Cage, the avant-garde musician back from the 50s and 60s and 70s. It was his heyday, and an experimental guy who you wouldn't normally associate with the Beatles, at least not until John Lennon connected with Yoko Ono.
Right.
But she was actually the gateway to that whole thing happening in that John Cage knew her in New York, and he was a collector of original manuscripts of modern-day composers. And by that, you tend to think avant-garde or classical. But the Beatles were big enough in the 60s, obviously, to gain his notice as something worthy to add to his collection. So Yoko's in London for an art exhibition, the one where she's introduced to John in November of 66. But in the fall of 66, she's in England. It's Paul that she first approaches on behalf of John Cage to hit him up for some Beatle manuscripts. And so between what John gave her and what Paul gave her, there's a 7 manuscripts from that time. And what's fascinating about them, I'd known about them, I'd read about them, I'd seen them online, but actually seeing them as I did, you know, they don't just bring them out for everybody. You have to have like a serious need for them. And so we did this for Chicago Tonight, and they literally have them under guard. There have to be 2 people in the room at the same time, at all times. Yeah. And they're in these acid-free Mylar envelopes. But I you know, as well versed in Beatles as I've been for decades now, and I think I've seen it all and heard it all, I have to tell you, when I was in the presence of these things, you could feel your heart change, your heart rate change, and wow. you were in absolute awe. I mean, it must be like, you know, seeing the Shroud of Turin
yeah.
for some people or something. It's just amazing. And you just, the humanity you gleaned from their little, you know, scribbles and doodles and asides and jokes and all this stuff on these particular songs. You know, it's not like you're saying A Day in the Life or Hey Jude or something
right.
for their best known work, but I mean, it's important enough. And the one for the word from Rubber Soul is hand colored with, you know, colored Sharpies. And,
oh,
you know, there's a story with that Paul described, you know, once they'd completed writing the song, they rewarded themselves by indulging in some weed. And, you know, you've got markers around, that's what you're going to do. So,
sure, you're going to start to doodle. You
know, yeah.
That is very cool.
It really speaks to how hard these guys were working in composing material on the fly between live dates and such. You know, this is a couple of them are written on envelopes, a couple are on spiral bound notebook paper, you know, common everyday things.
Yeah.
But these are classic songs that are in the DNA of a lot of people right now. So it's just amazing to experience that humanity at that kind of level.
And get to see the origins of this work that has lasted and for all these years and will continue to last. That's a very amazing story. A lot of news a couple weeks ago, was it just a week ago, Paul McCartney walked across Abbey Road again. And people lost their minds. Oh my God, he's recreating the iconic imagery. Why do you think it took so long for him to go back there, I guess?
Well, it's not the first time he's evoked that album cover. Back in the 90s, he did that Paul is Live album where he actually used, they'd airbrushed out the Beatle figures so it was as it looked in 1969 and put him in there walking Martha, his sheepdog. So he returns to that well. Now he's got a new album coming out, so, you know, why not?
Sure, you got to go back there. All right, we've been talking about all this great Beatles history. There's millions of Beatles fans around the world. Some of them will be descending on the Hyatt Regency O'Hare next weekend. You've been involved with the Fest for Beatles fans for years. What can people expect if they go to the Hyatt?
The thing about it is, you know, there are people that will complain year after year about, oh, the ticket prices are so expensive, or I don't need to go to the flea market because I can buy the stuff online now. But you know what? The reason you're going is you're going for access.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in years past, you could go and approach and pose for a photo with Klaus Voormann. You want to talk about Beatle history? Not only is he the guy that did the cover of Revolver, but he's the guy that discovered them in Hamburg in 1960 when it was a five-man group and stayed lifelong friends with these guys. I mean, talk about a Beatle insider. You know, Patty Boyd, you know, all these people that you would never, ever be able to shake hands with, you can access at the Fest for Beatle fans. So if for no other reason, that's absolutely a reason to go there. But more than that, for a lot of people, especially the out-of-towners, you know, this is their holiday once a year that they get to see old friends that live all over the country. They get to hang out and just immerse themselves in the full Beatle experience for a weekend. You can geek out as much as you want. You know, everybody there is a potential friend, you know, because, you know, you share the same religion, as it were.
Right.
So there's nothing else like that experience. And I think, you know, it's worth that, certainly, if you're that hardcore of a Beatle fan. I would say that, you know, the guests make it really attractive. This year, they've got Jack Douglas, who I don't think has attended a Chicago Fest before. He is, of course, the producer for the things he's known for, Aerosmith being his big success, but also he discovered Cheap Trick, produced
their
first album, and got them their record deal. Yeah, he discovered them in a Milwaukee bowling alley back in the mid-70s. So, you know, it's amazing. And he, of course, not only did he do some engineering work on some John Lennon solo albums, but he produced the final project, Double Fantasy. And so he was privy to not only John's last recording sessions, but he was literally one of, like, the last three people to see him alive. And when you see the Tomorrow Show DVD of John Lennon's 75 interview as a bonus feature on that, the Tom Snyder Show, they had Jack Douglas the day after it happened, and he's got the 1,000-yard stare. Here is a man completely shattered by the loss of his friend in such a, you know, a terrible and sudden way. So he's got stories to tell, including the fact that he was secretly tape recording John when John wasn't recording, just the conversations, And he kept all that stuff except for the one, the very last night of John's life, which he erased because he said there's some truly disturbing things said by John that in light of what happened that night, he didn't want to share with the world. So,
oh, wow.
You know, maybe if you go to the fest, you can talk to him about that. A lot of people have speculated, but you know, there's a guy with some history. We got Jeff Emmerich there.
Yes, Beatles engineer. Of Revolver and engineering.
There you go, yes. So he's got a best-selling memoir out there, and emphasis on memoir, because I think if you go through there, you'll find some exaggerations and things that aren't quite true, a little editorializing.
Okay.
But you know what? I will tell people, I loved the book written by Alan Williams, the Beatles' first manager, called The Man Who Gave the Beatles Away. That was a laugh-out-loud, funny book that, if you at all are serious about Beatles history, you know that half of it is nonsense. And you know what? You know, you're allowed to like your books that, you know, are sure. Just fun and not holy Bibles. So
yeah, you don't have to fact check everything. You know, it's not a test in school. And there's a lot of music there too. There's Beatles tribute bands that are there. You see a lot of different ones. Who are the ones that come? I'm looking at the Weaklings, Liverpool.
Liverpool's like the house band, and a lot of times when they've got, like this year, they've got, you know, Peter Asher, who of course is famous as one half of Peter and Gordon. Mm-hmm. Now he's the living half, and he had been a producer in the 70s of those hit James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt albums. He was nearly Paul's brother-in-law for the years that he was dating Jane Asher, so he's got that Beatle connection. He was the A&R guy at Apple Records who discovered James Taylor, and now he's doing an act with one half of Chad and Jeremy Klein. Ah. And so it's sort of this mashup of two British 60s duos. So they're going to be doing that, and they get backed up by Liverpool for the full band stuff. The Weaklings, their best-known member is Glenn Burtnick, who had been a member of Styx at one time. He is a left-handed bass player, got his start on Broadway as one of the Beatlemania guys.
Ah, all right.
And Paul. Yeah, and so it's a very, if you listen to Sirius XM Beatle channel at all, you hear the Weaklings a lot because they're very Beatlesque, and they do a lot of stuff in that vein. So they're a fun group. In fact, they did a gig with Marshall Crenshaw earlier this year that I saw. So if you like power pop, you like Beatlesque stuff, they're your band.
And there's also stuff there for kids. So if you're a Beatle fan, and you know, maybe your kids are Beatle fans, and your grandkids maybe are starting to get into it, and you're like, well, they might be too young. There's stuff for little kids at the fest too, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's art contests for little kids, and there's sound-alikes, and there's, you know, things that you can, like, pose for pictures in, like, you know, standing in the Sgt. Pepper album cover, things nice. Like that. It's a lot of fun, and the thing that blows me away, for all the years I've been doing the fest and, you know, signing my books at tables, doing programs and all that sort of thing, it is amazing to me how the age from one end to the other. There's the original fans, obviously, that saw them on the Sullivan Show, right. Now elderly showing up there that just, you know, they're brought back to life being in this atmosphere. They're just so rocking. And then these kids that you just wonder, how the hell did they get into the Beatles? But they can give you chapter and verse of their music. Or what's really cool is, you know, sometimes in the sound-alikes or the Battle of the Band, seeing the young kids up there playing these Beatles songs, and you tell the passion's there. It's coming from their heart, and they're not just trained monkeys. So it's just amazing. I know from my own experience, I've got a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old. I just took my daughter, the 12-year-old, to see Yellow Submarine on the big screen because it's the 50th year of that.
Right.
And it's not like I shoved Beatles down my kids' throats at all. You know, they would just push back on that because nothing's less cool than the music your dad likes.
Exactly.
But she loved it, and I gave her no preconceptions and just, you know, watch this movie, see what you think. She laughed at the right jokes and walked away saying, you know what, All Together Now is my favorite Beatles song now.
Wow.
Like, great.
Very
and this was
nice.
A month after we saw them, we took them to see Love Cirque du Soleil in Vegas. And
how was that? Was that good?
You know what? I'd waited this time all these years. It's been going since 2006 because I wanted my kids to be old enough to appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
And I almost went too far with my 16-year-old son because he's into hardcore rap and stuff. So,
okay.
You know, this is so far removed from that. He went away loving it.
Oh, good.
He absolutely did. Yeah. I mean, how can you not?
Yeah.
It is such a an immersive experience. And I have to say, you know, again, as much as I've been around the Beatles and absorbed them and think I've seen it all, I never expected to tear up at Yesterday, but I did during this. It's just amazing.
That's something to say. Now, and I mentioned, so the Fest is on August 10th through the 12th at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. Mm-hmm. You can go to thefest.com, and then you will be at Mather's in Portage Park on Monday the 13th, giving a presentation, The Beatles in Chicago. So can you... Just a real. I don't want to spoil it. But can you give us a little tease? What would be involved in that?
Okay, the first Beatle record played on American radio happened in Chicago with a guy up until recently was still on the air.
Dick Biondi. Yeah.
WLS.
There you go.
And they get the three shows they did here, 64, 65, 66. A lot of people who might be a little more than casual Beatle fans are familiar with when the whole Popular in Jesus thing blew up in their faces. There was that sort of press conference / apology thing where, you know, John was trying to address it and said, and now it's all this. That happened at Astor Towers downtown where they were staying.
Okay.
Chicago being the first city on that tour. Yeah. So, you know, there's that. There's VJ Records putting out the first American Beatle records. You know, that's a South Loop R&B record label that got the first Beatle deal after Capitol Records in Hollywood said, no way.
Very nice. Well, it sounds like another fantastic thing. People can go there Monday, August 13th. That's at Mather's in Portage Park, which is 3235 North Central Avenue in Chicago. And if you missed any of this information, go to revolverbook.com. That's Robert's website where you can find out all about the books, the articles, everything you need to know about Robert is at revolverbook.com. This has really been a treat, Robert. I'm really happy to talk to you, and I look forward to doing it again soon. Thanks for taking so much time with us.
Absolutely, Brian. This is a lot of fun. Great talking to you.
Take care. That's Robert Rodriguez. Again, revolverbook.com is how you can learn all about all of Robert's books and everything else. And then thefest.com is the Fest for Beatles fans, which is happening next weekend at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare. Let's do this, then there's more. For Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. It's where we go from talking about the Beatles, this iconic band who changed changed music here in America. They were the first wave of the British invasion and all that. The other night, Dan, this I hope you're not too jealous when I tell you that I went to see Lynyrd Skynyrd the other night.
Yeah, man.
It was it's one of the where I was having a moral quandary about this because There's certain artists that you like their music, even though you may not agree with some of their political views or some of their supporters' political views. But it's like, man, this music has been around forever. You know, I forgot because this is supposedly they're on their last of the Street Survivors farewell tour. They're never going to tour again because really there's only 1.5 members of the original Lynyrd Skynyrd, 2.5. I guess you'd be two. So one, Gary Rossington, founding member. Medlock, I think is, I can't remember his first name. He's the guitar player. He was in the band, but then left the band right before the crash and was back in the band. So he was, and then the singer is Ronnie Van Zant's brother, who basically has been doing his brother's songs since 1987, which is a weird. There was a weird feel to the whole thing, more like a memorial service and a concert, because they kept showing video of Ronnie and the other people who died in the band. And then toward the end, there was these candles with the names of all the people in the Lynyrd Skynyrd world who had died. And, you know, it's all the old band members and the backup singers. I was like, oh, my goodness. But thankfully, the songs were great, you know, the music was fantastic, and they've retired that whole Confederate flag thing that used to be the big thing. And it's funny, they kept running a commercial. There's a documentary coming on Showtime in a couple weeks about Lynyrd Skynyrd, and in it, one of the founding members is going, listen, the record label wanted a Southern band, so they put this Confederate flag thing on us. And, you know, all these hate-filled groups use a Confederate flag. And I love, this is the quoting the guy from the band. I love all people. I love black people. I love gay people. I love all these people. I'm a liberal hippie, and I always will be. But they wanted a Southern band, so they put this Confederate flag. So you didn't really see, except for one guy who was wearing it like a cape. So I don't know if he was like Captain Redneck. I don't know what his deal was. He was Johnny Reb through and through. So it calmed me a little bit because I was like, look, I can't, you know, I don't want to be a guy surrounded by people in Confederate flag shirts going, woo, let's go crazy. It wasn't that, but, you know, it was fun.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, sure, man. How often can you yell Freebird and it not be ironic? Never. But I yelled it like a lunatic. I yelled it like I had never heard Freebird before. It was because I was like, oh my, I'm actually standing in front of the people who wrote Freebird. Well, one guy
play
wrote,
Freebird.
One guy who wrote it and everybody else is just playing it. It's like a cover band when you're still the band. But this Leonard Skinner has been around longer than the original Leonard Skinner. So it's all right. Oh, my goodness. All right. On the other side of the news, oh, man, I got a pet peeve. The public once again has let me down, and we will we'll have to rail about it a little bit on the other side. But first, we must do this, then we'll do the news. Why? Because that's what we do on WGN. It's Brian Noonan in for Nick on 720 WGN. Nick's on vacation. He'll be back next week. We will be having fun all week. We've got some great guests planned. We're going to bring back the Overnight Arcade on Friday morning. So, so much to do. Dan, now I mentioned at the beginning that it was your sixth anniversary. Are you finding after 6 years now, not that you didn't do this before, but after 6 years, sometimes your lovely wife will come up with something she wants to do, and you know, even if it might not be what you want to do, you'll go, all right, you know what? I love you, honey. I'm going to do this anyway.
Yes.
Everybody does it. It doesn't matter if you're married. You could be in a relationship. Esmeralda, does your visitor friend, does he, you know, the man with the lizard head, does he...
Yes, V.
V. Does he ask you to do some things, you know, activities that perhaps you're like...
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, but you do it, don't you?
Sometimes.
Sure, because you care about somebody. Saturday it was what, like 95 degrees. It was hot. Friday night, I said to my wife, hey, we don't really have any plans for tomorrow. This is nice. We got nothing to do. And she says to me, oh, let's go hiking at Starved Rock. Now, you guys know me. I do like to do outdoor activities at some point, but I'm not an avid hiker, and I'm definitely not an avid hiker when it's 95 degrees out. There's something about exerting yourself too much in that heat sounds dangerous to me. But after 26 years of marriage, I also realized if we didn't go hiking, it was going to be a horrible Saturday. So we go, and I haven't actually been in Starved Rock State Park. I had been to the building across the river to see the eagles one time, watch them in the wintertime.
The band or the animal?
It was ironic because I went to see the animals, and Don Henley and the late Glenn Frey were there. And I was like, what are you guys doing here? Everybody said the eagles were here, so we figured we had gotten on the wrong bus. It was a crazy afternoon, but they did Desperado and Take It to the Limit, and then they left. And so, two songs, I'm good with that. An impromptu acoustic.
They were gone in a New York minute.
They were bravo. Actually, before I got there, they were already gone. But and then you know who I had to listen to then? The new kid in town. He did a couple songs. It was very strange.
Was he standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona?
Oh, it was such a fine sight to see, Dan. He wasn't a girl, though. My Lord. I don't know what he was driving. Looked like a flatbed Ford something. It was weird. Right now, everybody is banging their heads into their radio. Stop it, God, please make it stop. Oh.
Well, Nick hates the Eagles, so we don't get to have
really?
Eagle lyric battles.
How do you hate the Eagles? How does anybody hate the Eagles? I know why Nick hates the Eagles, because they're popular. I've said this to Nick's face, so I'm not talking out of school. Nick seems to hate things that are popular, which I get. It's okay. But I love the Eagles. I do. We went and saw them when they came through a few months ago. Even though, again, I was torn. It was another musical quandary. Do you go and see a band that's almost decimated? Not that the Eagles still have a lot of their members, so it's not like they were decimated. But I decided, well, I love the Eagles, and I like Vince Gill quite a bit. So now he's one of the Eagles. So, and it turned out fine. They did great. But... So we're back at Starved Rock. No concert yesterday, other than me moaning and the hiss of steam coming off my head because it was, as I mentioned, 95 degrees. Here's I enjoy going out in the wilderness. And if you do, I'm wondering if you feel the same way I do. When you're out in the wilderness, people should shut up. Even though you're outside, you shouldn't use your outside voice. Even on the signs before you leave the visitor center, as you go out onto the trails, one of the things it says is, live quietly. And I'm a boisterous guy by nature. I'm loud and obnoxious, and you threw, you know, whatever. You throw out any adjective you want. But when I'm in nature, I tend to become overwhelmed, and I let it affect me, as it should when you're out. Not yesterday, man. First of all, I couldn't believe how many people wanted to go hiking in 95-degree weather. It was insane, to the point where, as we were walking along one of the trails, we hear the whoo, whoo, whoo. It's a siren with the state police SUV pulls up. And the cop hops out. And I felt bad for this cop because he's in full cop regalia, the vest and the whole thing. And then he pulls out this giant backpack and goes running up a trail. I'm like, ooh, this can't be good. Followed about 30 seconds later by an ambulance coming up too. I was like, oh, no. So I decide we're not going to walk on this trail because obviously bad things happen. So we go off another one. But we circled back in time to see them bringing a woman down who had obviously overheated. Because let me ask you this, Esmeralda, you're a woman. That's not a question. That was the statement. I'm gonna go with that as the baseline. When you go hiking and it's 94 or 95 degrees, what would you wear? Like if you were going hiking with us on Saturday, you and V, and I know he's cold blooded, so it doesn't matter when a lizard goes hiking. Mm-hmm. But you as a red blooded, hot blooded woman, when you go hiking in that weather, what are you going to wear?
I'd probably wear shorts.
Shorts is a good guess. Okay,
Sneakers.
Okay, what about on top?
And a tank top.
And a tank top. Shorts
probably,
and a tank top.
Yeah.
And sneakers. That's a good hiking hot weather outfit. The woman they had to bring down from the trail was wearing jeans and two long sleeve shirts.
Oof.
That seemed excessive.
Well, jeans, I could see jeans, but the two long sleeve shirts?
Well, I'm guessing maybe the one underneath was not long sleeve, but she had a long sleeve like Under Armour, like one of those compression kind of supposedly wicking moisture, but it wasn't doing its job.
Right.
And then there was another shirt. You could see another shirt underneath. I'd be like, boy, two shirts when it's 95 degrees?
That's a lot.
I had a second shirt, but it was in the car because I sweat through the first one, and I didn't want to ride home in a wet rag. But I wasn't wearing two shirts. That's insanity. But here's my pet peeve, and this is what I'm wondering from you when you're out in public, something that really gets you to the point where it did not ruin my time, but it almost did, and it drove me crazy the whole time. We're out there, and people were just shouting. Everybody's talking real loud, and people were walking on these trails back in nature, beautiful, you know, as God created it back in the day. That's what God created it, right? Back in the day, is that what you say when you're talking about the creation?
I believe the third day, actually.
Back in the third day. Okay, I don't remember exactly the days, but anyway, one of those seven. People are walking around blaring music. And every time I would try to go, like if there was a big group of people being really loud, I would try to steer my wife down another path. We would go, because I didn't want to be bothered. This groups of young ruffians, Dan, young toughs, Esmeralda, in the woods. That's not where I want to run into young toughs playing gangster rap. You know, I expect to see that on the side of the road or at a corner. Perhaps outside a convenience store somewhere, but not on nature's trails. Just and the other thing is, people don't want to move. You know, some of the trails are very narrow and precarious. One end, you're going off into a canyon, and that's not going to end well. But people like they square up, boy, and they're not moving. So you gotta really be delicate. But I think, after Saturday's excursion, that now we are only going to hike when it's 85 or below. Because it's funny, we had, you know, the last time we went hiking? When was the last time we went hiking? Maybe 7 years ago? No, 6 years ago. We went to the Smoky Mountains. That was 6 years ago we went hiking. So it's not like we're out hiking all the time. My wife was about 10 minutes into the first to the hike, and she's like, oh, man, it's hot. And I'm like, yeah, it's hot. Have you ever been out there, Starved Rock?
I have not. It was actually one of the places we were going to go to the summer and kind of never happened.
Well, there's still plenty of summer left, Dan, and it's open all the time because it's a park. You can walk a lot. Am I right, Esmeralda? You're the traffic person. It's open all the time.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, you just hop on 80.
Free and clear.
Head on out there to Utica. Beautiful Utica, Illinois.
All right. I'll see you guys later.
Sure, it's fantastic. Well, it's dark now. You fall down a crevasse. You don't want that. You don't want to end up in a ravine.
That's 2.5 hours away, right? I mean, I'd get there in
2.5 hours. What are you taking, a donkey? It's 80 miles.
Isn't that close?
Yeah.
I thought it was closer to like Peoria down there.
Oh, sweet goodness. No. You take 55 to 80 and boom, you're right there. I think from my house, it said 86 miles. Took me less than an hour and a half because I drive 100 miles an hour. Yeah, it's not far at all. You get out there and you walk around. You don't need to pack a lunch for the trail, but you don't need to pack a lunch for the trip.
Hour and 52.
All right. So you live up in Wisconsin.
No,
so
that's from 303 East Wacker.
From right here? Yeah, but that's the suggested time. Has it ever taken you...
Ever takes me the suggested time.
No. Unless there's horrible traffic, I'm never... what is it, an hour 52? I'm an hour 30, tops. Because there's not a chance that I'm doing the speed limit. Unless I'm behind, Johnny Yokel in the left lane going 40. And then I'm just tapping him out of the way because I don't have time. I got to get out and crank up my gangster rap and walk around a path. That's what I'm going to do. Try to see some wildlife but scare it all away because I'm so loud. Oh, I just, please use your inside voice. Be warned. So there's different trails. There's a trail that goes along the river and there's stairs all over. They don't tell you that. I read the Bible. I know all about creation. God didn't invent stairs on the back in the day when he did nature, the whole nature thing. There were no stairs involved. Oh, man. They got some stairs at Starved Rock. It is insanity. I had a picture. Imagine, did you ever see Rocky, the movie Rocky?
Sure.
You know when Mickey comes over to Rocky's apartment and there's that big, long stairway? And it's going, imagine like 18 of those stairways. Going up, it's almost as we stood on the trail and we debated going up to the Bluffs Trail to take a different way back. Because, we're adventurous that way. I'm like Davy Crockett in cargo shorts. I'm looking up there and the stairs appeared to just be going into heaven. Which, ironically, the way my heart was beating when I got to the top, I thought I was just going to keep going. It was like an elevator straight to my demise. And halfway up the stairs, I swear this is true, I turned to my wife, who was about, two-thirds of the way behind me. We were both going up. These stairs were steep, in case you don't get the picture. I turned and I went, you know what? If I die, remember, this was your idea. Shut up! And I just kept going. So I get to the top, and my chest was pounding. And these little kids came up, and their dad, and the dad, his chest was pounding. He said, I got to sit down for a minute. And the kids are like, I need water. And suddenly Debbie comes up, and she's just like, I'm like, yeah. And every time we would get to a part of the trail, because you think once you're at the top of the Bluffs, there's going to be no more stairs except going down. That sounds fine. That's a load of garbage, too. There's a lot of stairs that still went up. I've lived in Illinois my whole life. I didn't realize that it was so hilly. Well, oh boy, you get out to Utica. Utica, they must have taken all the hills and just went, you know what, we'll put them in Utica. Because who's ever going to go there? We'll put them all in Utica. Well, now everybody goes to Utica, and we all got to climb these stairs. Stairs, stairs, stairs everywhere. Oh my God.
How did you deal with water?
Oh, Esmeralda, you would have been proud of me. I had back 6 years ago, we went to the Smoky Mountains. So we thought then we're going to be hikers. So I had gone to Walmart. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're a large retailer. And I bought these. They're fanny packs, and they hold two big water bottles. So now I look like a complete goon because I've got this giant fanny pack with water bottles strapped to my giant behind as I'm trudging up these stairs. But I was hydrated. And I learned this too. If my wife and I were ever stranded somewhere, I would survive and she would be dead because she drank all her water in like the first 15 minutes. And we were out there for a few hours because we hiked like 6.5 miles, which is not a lot. People now are going, really? You're complaining that much about 6.5 miles? Straight up and down, okay? That's where we're going to go with that. But I, by the time we finished, and she kept asking me, aren't you getting thirsty? Aren't you getting dehydrated? And I'm like, I'm not going to run out of water. I'm not you, human sponge.
Did she also have a fanny pack with two water bottles?
Of course she did.
Oh, wow.
But she doesn't know how to pace herself.
But you guys have all that weight on you.
Sure.
So
well,
that climbing up.
Are you talking about my dietary, my figure?
No, the water.
Oh, the water, sure. Well, they're not. It's not like 5-gallon jugs. I'm not a pack mule.
You know, just a little bit could be. These were so much of a weight.
Yeah, maybe quart bottles, 2 quart bottles on your back end. And then, you know, everything else I had. I didn't bring snacks, though. That was a crucial error. Because at one point she was like, do you have anything to eat? I'm like, no, I have all my water. Ha-ha! And then, but, so that you don't think I'm a horrible person more than you already do, we were halfway through, and I knew she only had, like, a little bit of backwash left in one of her bottles. And I said, you know, I still have a full bottle. She goes, I know, but I can't believe you didn't drink it. I said, I didn't drink it because I knew you were going to run out. And at some point, you would need me to save your life.
Aw.
I know. But then she got mad. I'm not drinking your butter. I don't need your butter. I was like, all right, you say that now because you know we're on the way back to the lodge. But if we were still way out there, you know, on a canyon, oh, you'd take my water. You'd take my water.
How long were you hiking?
A couple hours, like 6.5 hours, oh 6.5 miles, 6.5 hours. a couple hours, you know, 3 days. We were lost. We were actually drinking dirty river water. That's she wouldn't drink my clean water out of my bottle out of a sense of pride, but she slurped out mud water from a puddle just to stay hydrated. It was ugly. And ironically, we were only 50 yards from the lodge the entire time. But it was all straight up. It's horrifying. All right, we got to do this. I got to put my head down. So open up my climbing in, so take it easy. Did your record just skip? Like, wow, you rarely hear the record skip. You need to put a quarter on your tone arm. Keep it all weighted down like we used to do. You're laughing, Esmeralda. Back in the day, as an old man, you had to do that. Take a penny or a dime or a quarter, and you put it on the tone arm of your record player.
Oh,
so it didn't
smart.
Bounce around. Sure, that's you know, and then it just dug the groove in to the vinyl a little deeper. It's like, it's fun. Do you Instagram, Esmeralda?
I do.
I know you Facebook. Do you use any of those filters to make yourself look like a puppy dog or a gerbil or?
No, I you know what? I do play with them, but I don't put them out.
Good. Because here's another thing where sometimes I just want to take the human race and give it a smack on the back of the head. People are getting plastic surgery now to look like Snapchat filters. You heard me right. This is actual news, not fake news. This is a story that from the enemy of the people. A new phenomenon called Snapchat dysmorphia is making people seek plastic surgery based on what they look like with Snapchat filters. This is unbelievable. According to writings from 3 dermatologists from the Boston University School of Medicine, which is a fine institution. That is not, you know, Bob's House of Doctrine. This is a respected place. They say, quote, Snapchat dysmorphia has patients seeking out cosmetic surgery to look like filtered versions of themselves instead with fuller lips, bigger eyes, or a thinner nose. This is an alarming trend because those filtered selfies often present an unattainable look and are blurring the line of reality and fantasy for these patients. End quote. People are dumb.
I mean, I will say there are those Snapchat filters where it like just cleans you up and you look really good. You go, why don't I look like this all the time?
Like airbrush out wrinkles or rough spots or something? Well, that's, you know, that's not the same as I need an entirely new nose and please take my, you know, vanity surgery, I think, is just kind of crazy. And they say that social media is altering the way people see themselves because 55% of plastic surgeons have seen patients who want operations just so they can look better in selfies. And they say these people are suffering from body dysmorphic disorder, where you focus on the what you believe is a physical flaw, even though it isn't. Which I know is a real thing, and I know people suffer from that kind of stuff. But you know, to want to be like you look into one of these filters, it just seems a little nuts. I don't know why people. Hey, just listen. If you're homely, you're homely. People love you. It's okay. I mean, if you're suffer an injury or something, of course, get yourself fixed up. And you know, if you want to look like a dog, go ahead. What do I know? But I'll tell you this, you're not going to be happy as a dog-faced boy or girl. It's been proven. You can't work at the circus anymore. They don't allow that. The dog-faced boy, you can't make a living. So think about it before you go under the knife. You go, oh, man, I put one of these, rabbit heads on me. I got the long whiskers now. I want to go in. Doctor, give me a tiny little pink nose and then three really long nose hairs on each side and then make my ears go straight up. Oh, what do you want to be? I want to work as an Easter bunny. Forever? Yeah, I guess. That's not going to work out for you. All right, we got a lot to get to. The big debate. We were going to answer the big question on the other side of the news. Is a hot dog a sandwich? It's earth-shattering. This is the kind of talk you need to get you into your Monday. So we'll do that on the other side of the news, which we'll do after this on WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick D on 720 WGN. Nick's on vacation. He'll be back next week. All right. I saw this. This is a debate that has been raging since the late 1800s, I think. And I saw a new article on it today. So I thought, well, it's, you know, early Monday morning. Let's bring this up again. Let's open this can of worms and see what happens just for a moment. Hot dog, sandwich, not a sandwich. That's the question. 312-981-7200. It's an easy question. It's not a lot. And you can add to it, what does it have to be if you think it is a sandwich? Why? And if not, why not? Dan, hot dog, sandwich, no sandwich.
Not a sandwich.
Esmeralda, sandwich or not a sandwich?
I'm going to say a sandwich.
You're going to say a sandwich. I'm going to go with Dan, not a sandwich. Hot dog, not a sandwich. If you think that it's a sandwich, you...
Then what is it?
It's a sausage. It's a sausage. A sandwich. It's a sausage in a bun. It's not a sandwich. A sandwich is two horizontal pieces of bread with some meat in between it.
What about so any? What would you call if it was a Polish sausage?
Polish sausage. That's what I'd call it.
I see.
A Polish sausage.
Well, no, because you know there's no overall term for it.
Right. You just have a hot dog. It's just a hot dog. It's an encased meat. And that's not just me saying that. No, it's not just the author of this article saying it either. It's the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council says that it is not a sandwich. They claim that it is a sausage, and so then it does not qualify as a sandwich. It is just a sausage. And in order for it to be a sandwich, you have to have two separate pieces of bread, not a bun that is cut down the middle. And it's also the way that you eat it, because you would eat a sandwich, you can't eat a sandwich with the meat facing up like you do a hot dog. You know, hot dog, the meat faces up to heaven and to your mouth. Sandwich, it's all covered up.
What about a sub?
What about a sub?
I'm just saying the meat is facing up.
Is it? Who eats it? No. Meat is facing up? No, the meat's sideways.
I'm trying to think.
You're holding it like this. For those of you who with the visual radio, you hold it, which would be, I guess, Italian.
What about Italian beef?
That was the one I was going to say. That would, because it's a beef sandwich.
Yeah, but still, for the most part, you're going to hold it. How do you hold a beef sandwich? You hold it sideways.
You hold it up? No.
Yes.
Beef up?
No, beef sideways.
I don't know how you eat beef sandwiches.
Well, let's get some in here. I'll show you. I'm not a skeered. I'll show you how I eat a beef. You fold it so that the meat's to the side. Then you gnaw at it like a rat. Yung, 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 yung. Hot dog is a hot dog, according to this text, or burger is a burger. This is why they have their own names. Any place that lists burger or dogs under sandwiches, it all jumps about.
Is wrong.
Is wrong, yeah.
Hence why a place called a hot dog joint or a burger joint, not a sandwich shop.
That's right. And you never go in and order a hamburger sandwich. Hamburger's a hamburger. I'm not, 847 hot dogs a sandwich, 100%. No. Let me read you some of this. So, let's see. According to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, which you said you've talked to them before, Dan.
We have, yes.
And they say, no, it is not. Frankfurt, generally credited as the birthplace of the hot dog, hence the name Frankfurter. Locals called it a dachshund or little dog sausage. Some historians claim it was actually created in Coburg, Germany, and merely popularized and marketed in Frankfurt and Austria. One fact came screaming through the research. The hot dog, as in the sausage, is at least 500 years old. It is certainly older than sandwiches. So hot dogs have been around long before sandwiches. The Earl of Sandwich, the legend says, invented the sandwich. We all know that, sure. So the sandwich is younger than the hot dog. And if you argue according to this, well, Frankfurters may predate the sandwich, but the idea of eating them in bread is more recent, ergo hot dog or sandwiches made from putting a Frankfurter between slices of bread. You can't put a hot dog between slices of bread. You can't. If you try to cut it, then you fillet it. That's not a hot dog. Then you got some weird encased meat nasty sandwich. It's not. Then it's not a hot dog. And people have been eating food with bread for forever. Using it to scoop, you know, scoop up meats or scoop up hummus, whatever you're using to scoop up your bread. So you can't say, well, you know, a sandwich is the only thing. And again, I go with the slices. You have to have sliced bread to have a sandwich, not a bun, not a cantilevered bun. Somebody's arguing, what about a meatball sandwich? I would again argue that you're not, unless you can dislocate your jaw like a python, you're not going to shove those things in always with meat up. You're going to squish it together and then you're going to turn it. Because think about when you've got a meatball sandwich. Sure, the meatballs, they'll serve it to you with the meat facing up, but once you go to eat it, are you just like jamming it in there long ways?
See, I think I'd turn my head for it.
So you would
I move my head rather than the sandwich.
Is that right? You'll put yourself.
I think so.
In
like I'm thinking about it. Yeah.
So you'll be all awkward to hold this.
I do that like for tacos too.
Tacos.
You turn your head.
I'm trying to think. I turn my head and the taco though. I have too much turning. That's why I try not to eat tacos more than once a week because it hurts. I'm in physical pain with all my contorting. I don't want to contort that much during a meal.
One of our texters did say that eating a hot dog is more like eating a pita than a sandwich.
A pita?
Like a gyro.
I understand what a pita is. I'm trying.
But I think that would be.
That sounded much more harsh than.
That's
it was
fine. Like. You're closing in on 24 hours awake. I accept that.
I was thinking pita pocket. No, who eats pita pockets? Wow, what, did I just start echoing? Is there some weird?
That might be that the intercom's sticking again. All right, let's try.
All right, yeah, I was. I think it was God smiting me for coming in hot on the. I know what a pita is. Back off, Shagru. I know what a. I've been eating pita since before you were born. I was eating pitas before they were invented in Mesopotamia. I actually.
You're that old?
You know I am. I'm Methuselah-esque. And the esque stands for Esquire. That's right. So, wait a minute. A hot dog is more like eating a pita. How do I eat my. Again, now I'm forced to reconsider. I'm not backing off my stance. A hot dog is not a sandwich. But even when I'm eating a gyro, I fold, you know, you fold
right.
The pita, which is the bread part, Dan. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a round piece of bread. You kind of fold it in half with some meat in there and maybe some tzatziki, which is fun to say. Not so much fun to eat, but enjoyable
to
pronounce.
You don't like tzatziki sauce?
I know. I put
what?
The, I go sauce
it's the
on
best
the side.
Part of the gyro.
No, oh, man, that is, why, then why not just get a tzatziki gyro? Leave out
that
the meat
sounds,
and the onions.
That sounds delicious.
Does it really just pita slathered in tzatziki
that
sauce?
That is a delicious sauce. That's
not,
high on my list of sauces.
I'm not a big fan of condiments in general. Mm. I like the meat and the onions. Go meat on the grill, then the onions. Man, that's a fine, nice, dry kind of gyro right there.
I can lose the onions, but
really,
yeah.
Oh man, I love onions. Love a good onion. I'll have a little tzatziki, but I not see. I get it on the side because a lot of places put too much. They slather it on there. But now we're getting away from the main point, as if to distract us from the essential argument.
Yes,
but I'll go into a condiment discussion too. That's I don't care. What do I got to lose? It's 3:15. Where are we going? We got a lot of things to cover. There's chicken diapers that we got to talk about in a little bit. That's fine. The PETA text are very proud that they made me have to double clutch and try to figure out what was going on. No, I fold again to take the PETA reference. I fold it and then I eat it almost like a taco, which it is. It's just a bigger Greek taco. There's a whole, man, now I'm going into whole cultural appropriation and getting into a whole weird thing that we're going to get. I'm sure there'll be letters. How dare you call a gyro a Greek taco? You know, it's a soft taco could be, you could say that's a Mexican gyro. I don't know. But all right, I'm looking at all these texts and I'm not buying it. So, meat's been eaten with bread on bread between slices of bread for as long as there's been ample bread and meat available. Because we didn't have forks. Forks just came around like in the Middle Ages or after the Middle Ages because people were just scooping stuff up. So, I don't know. I'm gonna say no. Keyword, not a bun, slice. A trip to Condiment Corner? Oh, that was the Insatiable Insomniacs back in the day. They loved Condiment Corner. No, so that's it. There, I think we've settled that, haven't we? We've kind of put the kibosh on that. Dan and I agree that we both know what pitas are, which is fun. We know that hot dog is not a sandwich. We know that Esmeralda's neck is constantly at an odd angle while she's eating sandwiches and tacos and other. Are there other foods that you have to contort for? You have to lay on your back to eat a long john? What do you?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just
checking. I think it's just the tacos.
Do you ever have to put your hand all the way behind your head to eat an onion ring, or do you just pop them in like Tic Tacs?
No, those you have to do the dance with them though.
The dance.
They're hot.
Oh, where you take
throw them hand fingers and to the other hand. You're like hot.
Wow, can I give you a tip?
Just put it down.
Well, yeah, let it cool for a second.
No,
wear it like a ring.
Oh, that's.
Oh yeah, and then I get a big burn.
Sure, yeah, that all ring your fingers are burned. But you can make that scary face like Halloween face and be like Stranger Things. Now we're going to get into a hole. We're going to go down the onion ring rabbit hole. But I love onion rings. But I always liked. Remember, Orida made the onion ring with the chopped onions in it rather than the actual ring. I like those better because how many times have you burned your lower lip and chin because you took a bite of an onion ring, obviously like Esmeralda does when they're still in the fryer? That's when you kind of try to grab them out of there.
Yeah, I stick my hand in there.
Sure, because that's the best way. You want them nice and hot and crisp. But then the problem isn't the lava-like batter that is still boiling. It's the onion that will not cleanly bite when you're, even if you have a rat-like incisors to chop through it, you still, the onion will pull out and then slap down on you like a molten earthworm that just grabs onto your face. And it's horrifying. I don't need any food that could permanently damage me. You know, we've all burned our lip or burned our mouth on pizza. Have you ever burned it so bad that there's like pieces of flesh hanging off the roof of your mouth? That's when you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I call it, I looked it up once. It's called mouth beef. Yeah, like, or you eat fried chicken and it just tears up the roof of your mouth.
Yeah.
Mouth
or Captain
beef.
Crunch back in the day. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I know the term. I spent my whole childhood with mouth beef.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get enough of Captain Crunch. Oh, man. All right. they're giving you all sorts of tips for out of context. All right, let's do this. And then since things have gotten, I don't know where they went off the rails. I think with Dan insinuating that I don't know what a pita is, that kind of, I'm going to be honest, that stung just a little bit. You know, I understand.
Welcome back.
No, that's okay. It's nice to be here. I'm going to tomorrow. If I don't come in tomorrow with a case of pitas, then I don't know what's
the matter. I have some pita chips, if you don't know.
Oh, those are delicious.
If you need a picture.
What's that? That's like a just a piece of a pita?
Yes. Broken up.
It's
up
a Greek tortilla chip.
Yeah. Greek tortilla chip, sure. Cephalopolis, sure. It's a Greek tortilla chip. That's what we call it? Okay. Sure. Oh, my goodness. Management. Thank God management sleeps at night. You can imagine them up at this hour. What has happened to this once great station? I don't know. Somebody had a Greek taco. What do you call that thing they put it on again? Shell? Some sort of shell? Non-bread? No, that's a different. That's in made in a pot or an oven, clay oven. You ever had non-bread? It's kind of like a pita. N-A-N.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, all right.
Indian pita?
Sure, an Indian pita. Or an Indian tortilla chip. Or an Indian soft flour tortilla. However you want to put it. I don't know. All right, listen. People are putting diapers on chickens. Why? I don't know. But we'll try to figure it out after we do this on WGN. All right. Tomorrow it'll be Pita Fest on the big broadcast. We'll bring in our favorite pita toppings. Dan will explain what a pita is. Now, you don't do the pockets. You just go the straight up pita. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. No, a pocket, they just kind of being cheap and they just split the pita.
Right.
Yeah, that's.
No.
Nah, that's no good. That's no good. Well, it's healthier that way. No, it's not. Just eat the pita. Eat the whole pita.
Yeah, pitas are like the healthier option, right?
I don't know. You know what? I figure they're all carbs.
Yeah.
But I don't care. What am I going to eat a gyro on? My hand, just out of my hands? Like an animal?
I did have gyro strips today.
Did you?
Yeah, because we didn't have any pitas at the house.
So you just ate the strips?
Yep.
Oh, man, how was that?
Delicious.
You know what? You could have put them on two slices of bread and made a gyro sandwich.
That's true. That's it would have been a sandwich then.
It would have been a sandwich, right. Yeah, doesn't that? I mean, I remember back, when I was a kid, you wouldn't always have hot dog buns. So you'd try to, you'd cook the hot dog and then put it in a piece of bread. And ugh.
Yeah.
No. You gotta, no. All right. A lot of people are starting to raise chickens, or have started raising in the last few years. People are raising chickens. I know I know a couple people who are friends of mine on Facebook. They raise chickens. Oh, everybody! They want to get back to the earth. They want to be agrarian. As with everything, people take something that might be a good idea. Like if you want to raise chickens in your backyard and your city or town allows that, that's cool. I don't know how many eggs you're actually getting. I guess it's good to teach your kids about raising animals, and so there's nothing wrong with that. But chickens, Dan, this is something you might not know. I know you know a lot about breadstuffs, but you might not know a lot about livestock. Chickens poop quite a bit.
Do they?
They do. And this is not, I'm not saying that to be shocking or provocative.
Hot take.
Yeah, sure, it's a hot take. Chickens are full of what? That's my hot take for the night. That's how I do. Right now, Max and Orion are just shaking their fists. But it's true. Prove me wrong that chickens don't poop a lot. Well, so, because we're, as a society, goofy, people have decided we can't just have chickens running around our yards pooping everywhere, like they were, dogs. We little pita in my throat. We got to get diapers on our chickens. So now there is an entire industry of people manufacturing designer diapers for chickens. Not just, regular old chicken Pampers. No. Like with nice patterns and colors, and they want, you want the chicken's diaper to match your indoor decor, I guess, so that your chicken can come and sit on your couch and not drop a deuce right on your love seat. That's, again, I know sometimes I sound like the old guy just screaming on his lawn, but who's putting, if you're putting diapers on chickens, you're defeating the whole purpose of raising an animal. Animals do what they do. That's why they're animals. You don't put a diaper on it so you can carry Cluck Cluck around to your book club and go, oh, look at, isn't my chicken fantastic? Oh, yes, that is a diaper. He's not going to, don't worry, he won't poop on your couch. Let the chicken run around in the yard, peck at the grass, and poop where it wants to. If I were a forward-thinking human being, which unfortunately at times I am not, one, I would have figured out how to make pita a long time ago. Two, I would have also figured out, you know what? People are dumb. They're going to want to put a diaper on a chicken. I'm going to be the guy who manufactures those chickens. I may start it for dogs. Now I've given away a bazillion-dollar idea. Who's going to... Would you actually... You don't have a dog, do you, Dan? I know I know I have to take a break. Don't worry. I have two dogs. I'm not going to put a diaper on them. I barely wanted to put a diaper on my daughter, and she's a human girl. I'm definitely not going to take my dogs out back, go, come here, put them up on the baby changing table, powder their little bottoms, make sure they don't, you know, have ointment if they get a dog diaper rash. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it with any animal. You know what I am going to do? I'm going to take a break so Dan doesn't have a pita fit and go absolutely nuts on me. Hey, Vic, while you're still sitting there, I know you've got a lot of work to do. Could you repeat that story about the radio station, TV station shooting in Wisconsin?
Sure. WORT-FM, that's a station in Madison, a small community radio station.
Yeah.
What we know so far, and this is a reporting that's being done in Wisconsin as well as our affiliate at ABC, the shooting happened early Sunday morning, 3 a.m., a masked man got in, and police say that that man had a security code to get into the offices of WORT. It's an FM station.
Wow.
Yeah, and so he was able to, unfortunately, shoot one of the DJs. That person, I'm not sure whether it was a woman or a man, but that person was treated at a hospital and luckily was, you know, released.
Okay.
They were off the air about 6 hours.
That's crazy.
Isn't
that? It's, you know, and you wonder... I'm sure as the investigation goes on, we'll find out why. But you always wonder, you know, after the shooting at the newspaper and the constant rhetoric about the media being an enemy, you wonder how much that plays into it. I hope.
Yeah, no idea on this shooting yet. The police have actually said that they don't know what the motive was yet.
Yeah.
So no idea yet.
Well, we won't speculate then, but we'll keep an eye out. It's, you know, that's got to be that. Anytime you're working somewhere in the middle of the night, you know, there's not a lot of people around. That's a shame.
It is. We certainly hope the best for them.
Brother or sister in sound. Yeah. Good job. All right. I saw Esmeralda posted this. I will ask you an important question in a few moments, but I saw Esmeralda, you had posted about this, and I saw this very sad news. Former NSYNC member Lance Bass, denied a real estate purchase. I don't know if you heard this over the last couple weeks. The Brady Bunch house, or the house that was used as the exterior for the Brady Bunch show. I'm sure you remember that, Dan. You remember the Brady Bunch?
I do.
Okay. I think we're going to have to over-explain everything.
It's a show about this married couple.
It's actually the story of a lovely lady, Dan. She was bringing up three very lovely girls.
Gold hair, I heard.
Yeah, like their mothers. The youngest one, very curly. Well, then one day this lady is out, you know, I don't know, cruising a bar. I don't know where she met this fella. And who meets a fella? But they knew right away that it was much more than a hunch, you know. So anyway, the guy, by the way, three boys of his own.
Get out.
Four men living all together. Yet they're alone because they don't have the female touch. That's what you need. Anyway, so there's a house that they used. Wow, I think I've been hit in the head. There's a house that they used for these exterior shots, and it went on the market. It's in Studio City, which, as you can imagine, is near some of the film and television studios in Los Angeles. Very expensive real estate market out there, incredibly in expensive. This house was on the market for $2 million. Lance Bass, who I can't... He must still get NSYNC royalties, because NSYNC not perform. Correct me if I'm wrong, Esmeralda. You love the boy bands. NSYNC not currently in rotation, right?
They're not at the moment.
There.
No,
they're not. I did see a band. Sidebar, Your Honor. A couple weeks ago, we went and saw Boy Band Review. Have you ever seen this group?
I'm not in person, but I've seen them on WGN TV.
Oh my goodness! You got to see them live, especially at the zoo. Nothing better than a boy band cover group at the zoo, because that screams, man, we're on top of the world.
Where were they located?
They were at the Brookfield Zoo.
Well, I know that, but like the giraffe, by the rhinos.
Actually, near the dolphin show.
Mm.
Because there's a big open area.
A lot
area.
Of those guys are from Florida. So.
Sure. You got to keep them near the sea mammals. So they feel like home. They feel the crisp salt air in their lungs as they sing Backstreet. But that's a Backstreet Boys song. Why would NSYNC sing a Backstreet Boys song? Gosh, that's just wrong. Anyway, so Lance Bass still has money, I guess. As Esmeralda pointed out in her post, he got shut out of space. Well, he saved that money. He saved that space travel money so we can invest in real estate. So Lance puts a bid in on this house, as you've all done if you've bought a home. Puts the bid in. The agent says, hey, guess what? Congratulations, Lance. You've got the best bid. You're going to get the house. You will be living in the Brady Bunch house. Just don't play ball in the house. That's the only they said you can have the house, you can't play ball in the house. But you don't want to play ball outside either, because if you remember, it's an artificial turf yard. Horrible. Anyway.
Did he have to keep the Davy Jones posters up, or was he allowed to take those down?
Well, here's the interesting thing, Dan. The inside of that house is not the interior that you saw on the program.
What?
That was TV magic. It was all fake news. The inside of the house, not at all like the TV. No big staircase.
It's really disappointing.
Yeah. It is disappointing, isn't it?
It did seem very spacious for
I mean, that's what I would want in that house.
Oh, of course. If you buy the Brady Bunch house, you want the whole Brady Bunch look. You want
no toilet, you know.
Did they have a toilet in the bathroom?
I don't, well, the joke was, if you watch the remakes, the spoof Brady Bunch,
yes, okay.
They would always be like, they don't have a bathroom. Or no, their bathroom doesn't have a toilet.
Yeah, because they had the bathroom. It was between, that was a weird thing. All the boys and girls shared one bathroom. That was a weird, because anybody with boys knows, first of all, no girl wants to go in a boy's bathroom. Because men are like dogs. We just mark our territory. A guy wouldn't mind if there was no toilet. It doesn't matter. But, you know, I women hold themselves to a higher standard, which I admire. They want to, you know, they don't want to have to wear, you know, galoshes to go in and take care of their business. So, anyway, Lance gets told, hey, you got the house. Then they come back and they say no. He was later informed that another buyer, perhaps an evil Hollywood studio. I added the adjective. The story didn't say it was an evil Hollywood studio. I don't know. They might be very wonderful people. Unless you're Lance Bass. Then, man, he's got nothing but horrible words to say about them. They were prepared to acquire the property, quote, at any cost. That's, you know, you've got too much money when you're willing to buy something at any cost. Well, listen, this house, we've got it on the market for $100,000. I will pay $17 million for that house. Why? Because I hate Lance Bass, and I'm getting that house out from under him. Do you think that could be it? Do you think this is revenge? Like, maybe it's not a Hollywood studio at all.
What if it's the Backstreet Boys? Or 98 Degrees? Well, 98 Degrees wouldn't have that money.
Nuke is on the block.
What if it's Timberlake?
You think?
Ooh, the plot thickens.
Yeah. He was always so jealous of Lance Bass.
No, he's so sick of these other guys still riding his coattails that he's finally putting his foot down. I will make Lance Bass homeless. I don't think Justin Timberlake is that heartless. But I'm just throwing, you know, we love conspiracy theories. You know, Alex Jones called. He said it was Justin Timberlake. So you InfoWar that information and go with that. But then Lance Bass put out, he tweeted, he must have taken this, he put out a statement on Twitter vowing to get this house no matter what. He says, how can I compete with a $1 billion corporate entity? I truly believe I was used to drive up the price of the home, knowing very well that this corporation intended on making their offer, and it's not a good feeling. I feel used, but most importantly, I'm hurt and saddened by this highly questionable outcome. I just hope it is not demolished. Thanks for all the love and support. Wow.
I would think they would put it on some sort of list.
Like a National Historic Landmark?
Mm-hmm. What?
Nothing.
It could, you know, in terms of pop culture...
Sure.
Think it would be of importance.
Well, they said whoever buys it has to know that people stop all the time to take pictures of it. Had I known where it was, I probably would have gone. No, I wouldn't have. What about you? Hey, this is the house of Brady Bunch.
The wife and I went to the Frank Lloyd Wright house in lovely Rockford, Illinois last Saturday.
Is that right?
Yes. And
you went to Rockford?
We did. We were looking for a one-tank getaway.
And then you got there and put two tanks in just to make sure you never had to go back.
It was a lovely town. We had a good time.
I love Rockford.
And
you know that.
So we went to the Frank Lloyd Wright house. And because it was well known as a Frank Lloyd Wright house, the people who lived there all those years would just get buses of people just showing up randomly to like take pictures of the house. And they would just knock. And say, can we look inside?
Really?
And they were always accommodating. And the worst case scenario, they'd say, like, give us a half hour because we have to clean up. But other than that, they never turned anybody away.
Wow.
They were always, you know, the guy like worked in an industry where it was like he was always hosting parties. So it wasn't that too much of a thing to have.
Do you think he had pita chips out at all times?
I'm sure he did. Oh, I mean, who doesn't?
I don't know. Esmeralda's got them right now.
Yeah, I have some now.
Big bag of pita chips.
So good. But it was funny because like Frank Lloyd Wright was so popular in Japan that Japanese tourists, buses of them would come in
to Rockford.
And in Japanese tradition, you never go to a house without a gift.
Sure.
And so littered throughout the home are little Japanese figurines and beautiful sculptured things that they had amassed over the years people.
Did you have to make an appointment or could you just walk up and knock on the door?
But back then when the family was still living there, you could just knock on the door.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Because they appreciated it. They knew what they had.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was one of those things where they're like, this is a monument. We are living in a museum. And so we will treat it with the respect that it deserves.
Well, that's according to the reports, the owners of this Brady Bunch house, they didn't care if you walked up and took pictures of it.
Yeah.
That was just, like you said, they know. If you buy the Brady Bunch house, you know that's what's happening.
Right.
Now, let me ask you this. You went to Rockford. Did you see the clock tower before they tore it down?
We saw a version of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, because they're building up around it.
Yeah. There was the other day in the paper, they brought it down, the historic clock tower in.
Interesting. Yes, we did see it in time.
That's good. That's a landmark. You don't want to miss that. Had I known you were going, I would have told you to go to the clock tower and stop at the Quark. That was the big lounge in the clock tower.
Ooh.
Yeah. They used to do comedy there. Nothing like going up to the Quark on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Big time. That's right. Hey, speaking of time, it's time for a traffic and weather.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold like their mother, the youngest one in curls. It's the story of a man named Brady was busy with three boys of his own.
Just a
little girl. They were four men living all together, yet they were all alone. Till the one day when the lady met this fellow, and they knew that it was much more than a
You don't hear theme songs like this anymore. Now, I had not thought of the Brady Bunch theme, I don't know how long, until I saw the story that Esmeralda posted about Lance Bass being denied the purchase of this house. But the words came flooding back to me like some sort of horrible, horrible trauma. It keeps reliving in my head. I'm like most guys my age, which is old. I had an unbelievable crush on, it was actually Marsha Brady's birthday. Maureen McCormick's birthday just the other day.
Ah.
So I don't know. But, that was she and Susan Day, Lori Partridge. I had a thing for the ABC family sitcom ladies back in the day. And that was, I was, 10, 11. Those are the kind of girls you idealize. Then I always wanted girls who got hit in the face with a football. That was the kind of woman I pursued as my life went on. Have you ever been hit in the face with a football? No, I haven't. Tell your story walking, sister.
I know you're happily married, but that would have made a very interesting Tinder profile.
Yeah, that's it. That's how I do it. I my ideal woman had a big bandage across her nose. I'm trying to make sure I say this carefully because there's so many ways I could say it. Sure. That would be, get us in a lot of trouble.
Yes. Bill Leff's childhood crush was also Maureen McCormick, and he would tell a story on air about how he once met her and how she kind of flirted with him, and he kind of shut down. He just couldn't handle
it. Oh, he could have closed the deal.
Well, I don't know if he could have closed
the deal.
But it was just a lot to handle. That would, and then funnily enough, we had Julie Newmar on because she was
Catwoman.
She was appearing at Comic-Con a couple years ago, and she like meowed at him or something, and it again.
Oh, he had to go completely.
That was like the beginning of the show, and I just lost him for the remaining 5 hours.
Well, sure. If you know, come on, all the Catwomen. I don't care if it's Eartha Kitt, Julie Newmar, who is it, Lee Merriweather, any of the Catwomen. They come in because I'm thinking of them in that Catwoman costume. Or if Yvonne Craig came in, you know, Batgirl. Man, those out. I'll tell you what. For young men in the late '60s and early '70s. Those Batman villains and sidekicks were some outfits right there. Then you moved into Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, and puberty was just a wonderful thing. You know, you get to watch TV, and it was a simpler time. You know, I remember when Wonder Woman came on, everybody thought, "Oh man, this is so racy." And now I look at I'm not spending all my time looking at pictures of Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, but what I
allegedly.
You know, well, when the new Wonder Woman film came out, there was all the pictures comparing, you know, Gal Gadot or Gadot with Linda Carter, and you look back now and you go, that costume wasn't all that skimpy, you know, it was big Wonder Woman granny panties basically, and you know. So
high waist.
Yeah,
okay. High waisted.
Is that high waisted? All right, full bottomed. Well, how would we describe? Now, Linda Carter was not full bottomed. Her costume. All right, listen. Nobody said this was going to be easy. There's poor Dan has his head down on the console. Are you all right? Is everything okay?
Fantastic. I do. I am a little
Esmeralda,
hungry.
Yeah, can you get Dan a pita chip, please?
He wants the pita chips.
Oh, I would love some.
I think he needs an energy infusion.
Yes. We tried the deep dish potato chips. Patty brought them in last. Have you not heard of these?
I've heard of them.
The deep dish flavor.
I think the bag is still in the kitchen.
Yeah, if you want to try one.
I think I saw that bag in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't sound appetizing to me.
It wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it surprisingly tastes like pizza.
Really?
It's weird.
We were impressed.
Right. Wow. I'm trying to be better dietary-wise so I can get back in that seersucker suit.
What was that? What was the lunch this morning? Technically lunch.
This morning? Oh, I had some turkey, 2 ounces of turkey on a whole wheat or multigrain English muffin. So that was 3 points.
Is that a sandwich?
Sure it was, because I cut it in half. So it was two round pieces of bread. I sliced it.
Is muffin technically bread, though? I mean,
well, you know, listen. If they can get me some bread that has, I'm going all by points. I don't care now. Yeah. You know. The muffin. I count the muffin as a sandwich, because it was two separate pieces of bread, and then I had the meat in between. Well, you saw. I had the meat
I
in
did.
Between.
It looked delicious.
Sure. Well, I don't know about that. It was okay. But the good news is, now tomorrow it'll be 4 weeks, and I'm down like 17 pounds.
Ah, congratulations.
So, yeah, look at
Bravo.
That. Yeah, I got to get bikini weather for the winter, because I go opposite. Everybody else, I chub up for the summer.
You're a snowbird.
Sure, yeah, of course, because I'm not going to go to Arizona or Florida. And, you know,
Winslow, Arizona.
Oh, sure. I'll stand on the corner, but only in a Speedo, because I'm not going to go out there with, you know, all but gelatinous. That's no way to spend. That's no way to spend my winter months. Just jiggly in the desert heat. Blech. It just sounds awful. All right. We got to do this. Then it's news time. Yeah. Listen, there's the beep. That is upbeat. Brian Noonan in for Nick D on 720 WGN. Nick's on vacation. He will be back with you next week. We will share the rest of the mornings this week. I'm looking forward to it. We've got a lot of great guests. We're going to talk cars tomorrow morning with Tom Appel. And we've got some local filmmakers on Wednesday. I forget what we have.
Weissbaum.
Her Weissbaum is going to be here. And then Friday morning we're going to do an overnight arcade. So a lot of fun things coming up this week. Always always good to have you along with us. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It is also the text number. How convenient is that? Dan's daughters are still young, and I trust that Dan and his lovely wife are doing their best to raise them the right way. I think knowing both the mom and the dad, you know that the kids are probably heading in the right direction, which is always good. My daughter is she's grown and out of the house, so you know my hands. I wash my hands of her. She's on her own. I say that completely. Completely in jest, because actually, since she's moved to New York, I've talked to her more than I did in the 4 years she was in college. I don't know if she's just lonesome, but every night she calls, and we have, you know, talked for about an hour. It's nice. I'm glad she does. But I saw this today, and something that when she was growing up, everyone would compliment us on what good manners she had. And I remember my parents, even though I have four brothers, so the five of us were pretty much wild beasts. It was like Lord of the Flies all the time at the house. But when we were out in public, my mom and dad had taught us manners. And so we, to the best of our abilities, we tried to use those manners. I was perusing one of the websites today, and I came across something on etiquette, which we don't usually teach, or you know, you try to teach it at home a little bit, but etiquette changes and the social mores change and all that. So there is a number of old-fashioned manners that kids are not taught anymore. And I started looking at this, and I realized it to be true. And it doesn't have to be little kids that are affected by some of these. For example, the number one old-fashioned manner that they say etiquette experts are saying kids aren't being taught or need to be taught is talking in person more than by technology. Because I see this with, and I'm not slamming millennials, but I deal with people, you know, in their 20s, and most of them would rather, they don't want to talk. They don't want to talk in person. They don't want to talk on the phone. Everybody wants to send a text or an email. Or just an emoji with a picture of a poop or something, do we really need that emoji? I don't think we do, but I've used it continuously for the last 2 weeks. So phones often seem to replace in-person conversations, according to one of these etiquette experts. They say years ago, kids were taught how to speak with emphasis on language, speech, and diction, but talk has since taken a backseat to tech. It seems face-to-face conversation and talking on the telephone are a last resort in a world where kids much prefer to communicate by typing into their tiny smartphones. And it's true. I've seen people who they do not want to pick up a phone. And you go, just call me. No, I don't want to. Even sometimes with my daughter. Say, just, you know, she'll start texting me. And I can tell it's going to be an involved conversation with a lot of details. And I'm like, just call me. One, because I am not a fast texter. I don't hold the phone and use two thumbs. I'm like one. I text the way I type. I'm hunting and pecking. You know, it's like one finger. I get it done, and you know. But then I also use punctuation, which is not a thing. Kids need to talk more. Interpersonal communication is an art that is being lost on a lot of people, adults as well. It doesn't have to just be children. People don't know how to sit and have a conversation. Everything's got to be fast, short. We don't have the communication skills. This is now, Dan. I don't know if this will apply to your daughters, but this is something that drives me crazy. When children address adults by their first name, when they don't use, I'm over 50. There are still friends of my parents that I call Mr. and Mrs. whatever. It's just that's how we were raised. And it, again, I know sometimes I sound like I'm 117 years old, and I'm really only 115, but I look haggard. So I can understand your confusion. The president of a training and recruiting firm for private household staff say that children used to always call adults by their surnames, which we all did. Could you imagine? Now, you're younger than I am, Dan, but I know, you know, can you imagine growing up and calling an adult, hey, Bob?
Nope.
You know? No.
Nope.
Even my aunts and uncles, I still call them, I don't just call them by their name. I still call them aunt or whatever. It's just. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, my dad's friends, I still refer. I mean, I've known them my entire life, yes. And we have been together in social settings where it would not require the thing, but I do not feel comfortable without referring to them as Mrs. Baird or Mr. Kartheiser, yes. Or Mr. Kazin.
And you're a grown man with a family.
Right.
But that's still, that's just, it's ingrained in you. They say it's because our society is more casual. Is it, or are we just lazier? You can just say. So children are off, but there's also the phenomenon of adults who want to seem like they're friendly. We're accessible. We're friendly. You're our equal. You're not just a child. You're just a shorter person. And you can, you know, my name's Brian. You can call me Brian. No. When Molly's friends would come over, I'm always polite, but call me Mr. Tibbs. And they go, but your last name's Noonan. I go, I know, but you got to watch In the Heat of the Night, because then you'll really, that's how you know what to call me.
I kind of have issues with that, with the whole calling, at least in terms of my family. So I went to go visit a family in California, and okay. They're my cousins, and then they all have kids, and all the kids are conditioned to call essentially me, because I would be their second cousin.
Yeah.
But they don't call me by my first name. They call me Tia,
okay.
Which is aunt.
Right.
And it weirds me out because no.
You don't want to be aunt?
No.
Really?
I don't know why. It just weirds me out because it feels
just
like
Esmeralda?
That. Yeah, I'm Esmeralda. Why are you calling me that?
Because you're an adult woman.
I know, but it's weird. It weirds me out.
A position of respect and power.
See, that weirds me out. I think that's what it is, because I almost feel like, no, we're still, I'm a kid.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah,
come
exactly.
On, guys.
We're not adults. We're still 18.
Yeah. Well, listen, trust me.
That passes?
I understand that feeling. But no, it does. It never passes. Well, it should pass at some point. But
when you're climbing stairs to Starved Rock,
then I just know I'm not 18.
I think I'm
in better shape than I was when I was 18. So,
that's okay. True. The thing, kind of, I think, to Esmeralda's point, though, is that there's a lot of people who don't want to be called Mr. Noonan because that's my dad, you know? Like, okay. It's that old, like, well, I'm not my, you know? Like, so what we ended up, we haven't really experienced it yet, but the go-between that I noticed kind of later in my younger brother's lives was that if it was somebody that wanted to be called by their first name, it would be Mr. Len. Yeah.
Okay.
Or Mr. You know.
Okay. Now, all right. I'll buy into that.
Right. Mr. Bob, you know, and so
yes.
It's still a little bit, but it wasn't, you know, it was addressing an adult and an elder and a little bit formal.
But then everybody sounds like a preschool teacher at
right.
That point. Hi, Mr. Dan and Ms. Esmeralda. I'm Mr. Brian. Oh.
Wasn't that in the South? Don't they kind of do that?
Yeah, kind of. We had neighbors that did it when our first house, there were two twin girls that always called my wife Miss Debbie. I thought it was so cute. Oh, Miss Debbie, it does sound very Southern. Like you have to go have a sweet tea before you get a vapor. You don't want the vapors, Esmeralda. Especially.
I know. I saw what happened to you. So.
Right. You know. Oh man, no, you don't want the vapors. All right, we'll get into some more of these old-fashioned manners that kids aren't taught anymore. But first, we must check the weather and the traffic, because that's what we do. Brian for Nick. We're talking about some old-fashioned manners that kids are not taught anymore. We were talking about addressing adults by their last names. Text from the 870, I'm 47 living in Arkansas, and I call my neighbor who is 87 or 88, Miss Betty. When I say ma'am to her, I get smack. Got to blame saying ma'am on my Scottish grandmother raising me. And from the 708 in the South, they also used military rank as a show of respect, like Colonel Angus. I see what he tried to do there, but we didn't fall for it because they typed it different. I know what you meant. 312-981-7200. John has been hanging on. Hi, John. Whoa. Wind tunnel, John.
No, I'm at work here now.
All right.
Yeah, I just added a comment there. I'm not blaming the parents, but I'm sort of going to accuse them of being the guilty party here. Because, you know, you have kids that are young and, you know, I mean, they should be taught how to go about addressing adults. And nowadays, with, like you mentioned, this technology and them being on their phone, they've sort of lost that touch with reality, you know. And You know, they'll learn about it in their upcoming years, but I'm blaming parents for not showing the etiquette wise care.
Yeah, even if you want to have a more casual relationship with your kids, they have to go out. Are you all right, John?
Yeah, like I said, I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. What do you do for work? What's your job?
I work for Ford Motor Company.
Ah, very nice.
So, yeah, my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, beautiful people, and they have young kids, and one of them addresses me by my first name, and I don't take it that serious there, but it does sort of affect me. I would rather be called Uncle John than being addressed as, hey, John. It sort of upsets me there, but I don't mention it. I mean...
Well, now you've mentioned it to all of us, John, so we know that it does bother you, and hopefully the message gets out to them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care, John. Be careful at work. Have a great night. It's just one of those. I know it's in the whole scheme of everything that's going on in the world, it is not the biggest worry. But, you know, when you go to work, when you first get jobs, usually it's Mr. and Mrs. for your boss, unless they go, well, just call me, whatever. Don't call me Tia, because that, Esmeralda will get upset if you do that.
Must he be T.O., but yes.
T.O., yes. Oh, sure, because I'm a man. That's why I'd get upset if you call me T.O.
Question mark.
What's a PETA? Standing for introductions. If you meet someone new, do you stand up when you are introduced to them? You should.
I try, unless it's socially awkward for me to get up.
Even if you're a lady?
No, ladies can stay seated.
Yeah.
Ladies stay seated. I'm talking just to the men, to the gentlemen.
The
so, what do you mean? The Tios, the Titos. All the Jackson 5 should stand up. Every last one of them. Jermaine, Marlon, Michael, rest in peace. All 5 of them. Jackie, get them all up. On your feet, fellas. All right, enough. Enough of this. What do you mean by socially awkward to stand up? You're not in sixth grade.
No.
Go up to the blackboard. I can't. Puberty just kicked in. What? I can't go to the blackboard because who even knows what a blackboard is anymore?
That's right. Suddenly it's like whiteboards.
Or smart boards.
Right.
Oh, the smart board's a beautiful thing when it, you know, the one time it works. What's socially awkward?
No, but
about
just like, you know,
up?
if me standing up is, you know, like if it's a tight space. For example,
Being introduced to veal?
No, it's, you know, like, for example, at our holiday parties, I have 25 cousins and 8 uncles and aunts. And so,
well, but you're not being introduced to them for the first time.
Right, but it would be one of the cousin's boyfriends
or
something.
Okay.
You
right,
know?
Right.
And if I'm like at the Mary Kay's table and, you know, it's seats 7 and there's 10 of us surrounding it because we're all sitting around there talking and things like that. And like I would try to stand up and then I'd bump into the people sitting on the church pew behind us.
You make the raise. Little air between your bottom and the seat.
Right.
And that's I'd count that.
Right. Okay.
It's a show of respect.
Right.
Yeah. I give you carte blanche on that.
Okay.
One. Sure. Because then people go, oh, don't get up. And you go, okay. And then you plop back down, even though you really only got up, you know, an inch and a half.
Smidge.
But working the glutes.
Yes.
That's how, oh, man, you stay low. You hover over the seat. Just like a lady in an outhouse. That's how I do it. Are you all right? Is everything okay?
No, I mean, I'm doing good. This is very funny.
All right. Sitting down for family dinner, that's not really a manner. That's just, you know, but because families are busy, we all know that, you don't always have time to eat as a family. So that, I got no problem with that. Because people, you know, kids are in activities, parents are working, there's all of that. But, go ahead.
I was going to say, I bet they think, you know, sitting around a TV. That would be the...
Oh, yeah, no, that would not be good.
I think that's what they mean.
They're saying that families aren't sitting down for meals anymore.
Oh.
And
well,
so that's, you know.
Yeah, but like you said.
Yeah, during the week, I mean, there's a lot going on. If you have one kid, there's a lot going on. Plus, if you're working, you know, people can be on different schedules, so you don't always sit down. So I don't have a problem with that. But what they're saying is part of that not sitting down for family dinners is then meaning that kids don't know how to set tables correctly, and they don't also know how to then, if they're seated at a table with a lot of stuff, they don't know, you know, use your utensils from outside in, keep your bread plate to the left and your drinks to the right. It all kind of stems back to the fact that because we're so busy and because so... You're laughing, Esmeralda.
Who's
you
got a bread plate at their family table?
Listen, a lot of fancy people... Esmeralda.
You throw that thing on a napkin.
I'm going to ask you one question. Where are you going to put your pita if you don't have a bread plate?
You throw it on a napkin.
On
the table, because whatever. It's
trick
your family table.
Wow. Trick question. The pita is going to be eaten.
Ah, very good.
It's in as a sandwich.
Who just throws their bread on the table?
I mean, if I got nowhere to go with it,
don't you put
my plate's full?
I concur with that statement.
I mean, you know where your table's been. It's your family table.
Well, I don't know what happens when I'm not there. I'll put it on a napkin. I'll go with a napkin. I'm not just going to drop it on the table.
I mean, there's not stuff on it. It's just a dry thing. You pick it up. There's
just
maybe a little bit of
crumb. Housekeeping. I understand you keep a tidy place, Esmeralda. I'm just saying, your idea of putting the napkin down is fine. It just it'd be like, you know, eating off the floor. I don't put my food on just a surface.
Wow, eating off the floor.
Well, sure.
It's totally not the same thing.
All right. Well, maybe I walk on my table. Because I don't want to. Maybe I keep my floor clean and my table is high traffic. Maybe I do a Krav Maga or whatever that is. Not Krav Maga. Parkour, where I'm jumping from surface to surface. I'm parkouring all through the house. My entire home life is based on hot lava. So the floor is hot lava. I never can walk on the floor. But if I want to, you know, fondue something, I drop it into the hot lava. Then I dive onto the floor and eat it.
Right.
That's how that works out. All right. We have things to do. Dan's telling me I have to take another break.
Oh, I was telling him to go to line one. Because we have Glenn on the line.
Oh, Glenn's on the line. Well, let me go talk to Glenn. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm good, Brian. Hey, a couple of things. When I was down south, I was much younger, and I got transferred down. I was in my later teens, actually, as a manager down there. And the community down there addressed me as, you know, hey, good afternoon, Mr. Glenn. And in respect, I addressed them back. Even though they were much, much my senior, you know, I addressed them back as, you know, Miss Jean, Miss Nancy, whatever.
Yeah.
And that was just out of politeness. And in regards to Esmeralda's comment is the fact that I married into a Latin family, a Hispanic family, and I was the only one addressed as Tio, as that was their way of showing me respect as welcome to the family.
Oh.
But I was the only Tio where all the other members of the family, all the other gentlemen who were uncles, were addressed as uncle. So,
now, did you chafe at the title? Like, Esmeralda seemed very put out by being called Tia. Glenn, did Tio bother you?
No. Actually, I understood the respect that they were trying to give me.
Yeah.
So I appreciated it a great deal. And to this day, my children, even when we go out to dinner or something like that, somebody comes up, one of my friends come to a table or something, my son will stand up and my daughter will address the adult as, you know, I'll introduce them. This is Mr. Smith or whatever, and they'll return the respect by saying, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Smith," or whatever. I think that's just the groundwork of proper. You know, people earn respect,
yeah.
And sometimes people also earn their ranking or their title. You know, Mr. or Mrs. is still a ranking and title. So
sounds like
it's
you're
just
doing
a deem of respect.
Sounds like you're doing a great job, Glenn. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I'm. Thank you.
Take care. All right, let's do this. Then it's news time. Then we'll do a couple more of these. And, oh, boy, Costco is a hotbed of anger. So we've got a lot to talk about in the final half hour here. Let's do it. Thanks, Vic. Brian Noonan in for Nick D. He'll be back next week. He's on vacation. I will be with you this week. Very excited for that. Working with Dan and Esmeralda and Vic and trying not to drive Dad too crazy. Tomorrow, big pita day. It's pita Tuesday, pita Monday, Tuesday, whatever day it is. We're talking about manners, old-fashioned manners that kids are not being taught anymore. The last one we were talking about was calling adults Mr. and Mrs. and setting the table, that kind of thing. From the 815, I was elected to a school board, and people who used to call me by my first name now address me as Mr. There's a good, I think there's a formality in some things that we need to adhere to. I don't think we need to adhere to it in everything, but sometimes you need a little formality. And I think kids will have enough time in their lives to become more lax with manners and things. But if you give them a good foundation, then at least there's something to build on, you know, or at least they have something to tear down. If you never give them anything, how will they even know what to rebel against? So another one of these old-fashioned manners that they say kids are not taught anymore, according to etiquette experts, is asking for permission. Now, my daughter is too old for me to know if this is really a thing. They say when children used to have to ask their parents for permission before taking or doing something, and the rule often does not apply today. You're the only person I know with young children, Dan. That doesn't seem possible.
I mean, she's three. Well, you know,
I don't know how much freedom you give her.
Yeah, I mean, she'll walk up and, like, take my phone out of my hand because she wants to see something on it, but she's three, and then,
yeah,
you know.
That's young.
She doesn't want to go to the mall yet?
Not yet, thank God.
Okay, she hasn't asked permission to cross the street?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, like...
But you will teach
when
her.
When we get to that age,
of course.
You know, we were already doing, like, ask your mother, you know, I'm already doing that, you know.
Which translates into dad can't be bothered.
Right. Or like dad doesn't want to get in trouble for this decision.
Ah, yes. See, that's always good. You pass the buck, Dan. You're going to learn that as the girls get older. Pass the buck. Easy. Not speaking unless spoken to. See, this one is a little too old-fashioned even for me. Because when I was growing up, there was the children should be seen and not heard. And that meant you could just sat there like a lump until an adult talked to you. And then, you know, then you could answer them. But I think now it's a little different, and I'm glad of that, because you don't want a kid who's just going to interrupt. You got to teach the kids not to interrupt. But you also have to teach children they don't need to be afraid to speak. You know, if there's somebody there and you want to have a conversation, you can interject. You can have your opinion, but you can't be obnoxious, and you can't try to manipulate the conversation, and it can't be, look at me. You have to let other people talk. But I don't think the days of just having a kid sit in the corner and be absolutely quiet until an adult deems it necessary or deems that it's okay for them to actually have something to say is necessarily the way to go. So that one, look at, I'm progressive, Dan. I think the kids would say I'm woke with that. I'm enlightened right there. That was pretty good. Getting dressed up is another one they say kids have a problem with because, of course, we all want to wear nothing but pajamas all day. So they say anytime, you know, a kid has to get dressed up, they chafe. They get crazy. Do the girls like to get dressed? Little girls always love to get dressed up, don't they? Or most do. I'm not going to say all.
I mean, I was forced to put on her bell dress yesterday for church.
Oh, really?
Yes.
She wants to go princessy for church.
She wanted to go princessy for church. I'm like, fine. If you put it on, I will I will let this happen.
As long as we go, it's okay.
Yes.
So do they like, they'll wear dresses?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
does it
right
have
now
to be the costumey dresses, or can it be like a regular
dress? No, they are good about it. But, you know, it is interesting because I'm kind of much more of a stickler on things with coordination now than I ever was before.
Like not falling over?
Well, yes.
Color coordination.
Please, I'm like, don't trip. but like, because if I'm going somewhere without Eileen, like, I don't want them to look sloppy because then they'll be like...
Reflects bad on dad.
Right, because dad doesn't care,
yeah.
You know? So, I'm like the bloomers I put on under the princess dress, they color coordinated because
of course.
You know, somebody be like, right. What's that?
Now, were these functional bloomers or decorative bloomers over functional bloomers?
They were functional.
Functional bloomers, yeah. All right.
But yeah, I mean, I do think, like, you know, I mean, I can understand the want to have pajama pants, and, like, I'd like to wear my track pants anywhere I go, but at least I make them look like, you know, it's not my track pants with, like, that I use to paint something with,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're presentable track pants.
Listen, you're talking to a guy wearing cargo shorts and a Hawaiian shirt. I'm all about comfort. But I also know that there's a time and a place where you have to get dressed up. And that was another thing that I guess my brothers and I all learned this from our dad. There was a time that you got dressed up, and that was from a guy who had to wear a suit and tie to work every day. You know, as a principal of a school, he was always in a suit and tie. So we all kind of like that. And it says here, weddings, funerals, dates, theater, and Broadway shows should be treated as if they are special. And I mentioned this with Carl and Lisa when we were doing Crosstalk, it seems like 3 days ago. But I'm always amazed, and I know this makes me sound like a snob, but I'm always amazed when we go to the theater and I see people dressed at the theater like I'm dressed now. I would never in a million years go to a show at the Oriental or a Cadillac Palace or any of our other wonderful theaters or even a smaller theater, you know, dressed like this. And I know I can't control what other people do. I weep for a loss of decorum. Weep seems strong. But, yeah, I do. I weep because I'm emotionally unbalanced. But, all right, being cognizant of hygiene, another manner that they say is not being taught to kids. I don't know who is not teaching their kids to have hygiene, unless you're raising your kid, you know, wearing a chicken diaper or something. Some parents no longer seem to emphasize hygiene, such as children covering their mouths when they cough or sneeze. Well, I'll be honest with you, that's being covered at school nonstop. So even if you're falling down as a parent on the cover your mouth when you cough or sneeze, trust me when I tell you this, in school, we are drilling that into children's heads nonstop because young children are just faucets of bacteria and fluid and gunk. And so you have to tell them to cover their mouth all the time.
I think it's parents that aren't, because they won't do it. Because I see people all the time just coughing out.
I know, how do you not
cover? And it's like, ugh.
Yeah, and you know stuff, and I'm not trying to be gross, but you know stuff's flying out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's viscous or not, there's still stuff.
Yeah. No, I've had to tell people, vampire. Vampire.
I was going to ask, do they teach vampire at the schools?
I don't use it. We don't use that terminology, but we say, yeah, cough into your elbow. Because I don't want to, you know, vampire, kid's going to start biting. All the kids aren't smart. Let's be honest. There's some kids who you got to spell it out. There's no abstract. We're not, God bless them. Everybody's not meant to be a genius. Some kids, you got to paint the picture. I don't mind painting a picture. Cough into your elbow. Nice and easy. There's no question there. There's no, am I supposed to wear a cape? Do I sleep only at the daytime? What? No, vampire is too confusing for some kids. Some kids would get it. Oh, I love the analogy. That's very apt. No. I deal with little kids, first, second graders, which is scary in its own right. But they're, you know, subtlety is lost on a first grader.
Well, I saw it because Sesame Street.
No, it's perfect.
And it was the count.
No, I think it's a great analogy. It's a good descriptor, but I couldn't use it, you know, mostly because I'd forget. And finally, they say writing thank you notes and handwritten letters is something that is not being taught to kids these days, which is true. But I will tell you, it is important to teach your kids to do this. Molly has a job now. You know, she's an adult. She's a grown woman. So she was interviewing for a different position at this agency. And she had the interview and she sent an email thank you to the person that she interviewed with. And she ended up not getting that position. But when she sat down with HR and they were they give them a recap. Hey, here's what we heard went on in your interview and blah, 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 blah. And the HR woman said to her, now this had no bearing on the decision one way or another. But you should do a handwritten thank you note after you interview with somebody here. And so it's an important skill. And, you know, when she graduated and people gave her gifts, it was send a note. Oh, no, can't I just send an email? No. One, we paid to buy these, the special graduate package with the thank you notes in it. So there you go. Boom. I bought the thank you notes. Here's a Bic, get to work. But now in her professional life, she realizes she's going to have to write thank you notes. So she has a package of thank you notes in her bag. And if she interviews with somebody or something, boom, 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 boom. They're saying cursive. No, cursive. It doesn't have to be cursive writing. You could just write, you know, you can print however it is, but you have to know how to write, right? They're still I'm trying to think now if we're still teaching writing. Yeah, we're still teaching writing in school.
Do you teach cursive?
No cursive. Mm. Well, like I said, I was only in first and second grade. I'm trying to remember when we learned cursive. It was maybe second grade when we started learning cursive. Yeah, but they don't teach cursive anymore. It's a lost art.
I'm kind of mad that I don't know how anymore.
I
probably do, but I haven't done it in so long.
Yeah, mine is real sloppy.
It looks real bad.
Well, mine's always been sloppy.
Yeah, probably looks like those second graders.
I know it every time because when I go vote, when I first signed up to vote and, you know, signed my name for the first time, I did it in cursive really beautifully, and now I just scribble.
Oh, really?
And I've always scribbled.
So, oh, yeah. Like, I it's funny because, like, I have to, like, because they make you sign, so I have to do it very slowly to try to go back in my old days.
And yeah, I find now when I have to sign my name, you can tell it's a B and an N, and then there's just a couple lines.
Yep.
Yeah, same.
You know, I sign it like a doctor. If it's good enough for Marcus Welby, MD, it's good enough for me.
That's we're all doctors.
Yes, everyone's a doctor, and everyone gets a trophy. That's how it is. Everyone gets a
medical and a PETA.
Oh, sure. Oh. Tomorrow I'm going to be like the Oprah of PETAs. I wish one of these windows would open. I would fling them out onto Columbus Drive with impunity. I'd just be flinging PETAs. All right, let's do this, and then we must talk about Costco and how senior citizens are getting a little out of hand at your local Costco. All right, Brian Noonan in for Nick here for another few minutes. Then it's the opening bell with Steve Grzanich, and the Steve Cochran Show follows that. So a lot of things coming up this morning. You do not want to go anywhere. Definitely. Oh, my goodness. You don't want to go to Costco because things are getting. I love Costco. Got one right by the house. I go there for my gas because the gas is always cheaper there. And I go there for my watermelons. Which is an odd thing because they've got the big seedless watermelons, good price. You would think, hey, can't you get them at Sam's too? And I love Sam's. So I have memberships to both. I don't know why, but I do. I go to both, different things at different places, all summer. And I tried this a number of times. Every time I got a watermelon at Costco, fantastic. Every time I got a watermelon at Sam's, subpar. And I thought, well, maybe I just got a bad one at Sam's. No. I tried three different times. I went back. I don't know what it was because they look the same. The labels seem to indicate that they may even be from the same farms. I don't know.
Interesting.
It is interesting. I like Costco seems to do more of the free sampling, which is the problem with this story. So I understand the allure of the free sample. I'm not immune to the siren song of a tiny little piece of pizza or a piece of sausage on a toothpick. No, I'm not immune. I'll give myself over to that sometimes. But it always amazes me the people who treat this like they've been in a bread line in the Soviet Union for 14 years. This is from a South Carolina Costco, and I don't know if it's different in South Carolina than it is in the Chicago area. A fight between two senior citizens over free food led to police being called to the Greenville, South Carolina Costco last week. According to the newspaper, an argument broke out. A 70-year-old man, 70, was waiting for his complimentary bite-sized chunk of cheese. And now, granted, they do have some fine cheeses that they give out at Costco. I'll stand around, get myself a piece of cheese. How long will you stand waiting for a free sample? Like if you see they're about to take the pizza out of the little toaster oven, will you wait? Or do you think to yourself, if I want pizza, I'll buy a whole pizza?
I'll give. If it's just coming out of the oven, I'll wait.
You'll wait? Okay.
Yeah, wait. All right. If there's time on the microwave, though.
You're not gonna wait?
Okay. Grocery shopping should be an efficient exercise.
I agree with you 100%.
That's right.
Move on. Well, the 70-year-old's waiting for his cheese. Then a 72-year-old man who's, you know, maybe one step closer. He doesn't have the time that a 70-year-old has. That's all I'm saying. He's sensing his mortality. He's got to get his cheese. So he jumps in front of the first guy, snatched the cheese, and walked away. So now the 70-year-old, you can imagine, a little upset. So now the 70-year-old wanders off. He's going down. Oh, hey, look, there's a cheeseburger sample. I'm going to get in line. Well, and I love they did describe the 72-year-old man as wearing a Hawaiian shirt, as if everyone who wears a Hawaiian shirt is some sort of scofflaw. Not a fan of that part, but that's okay. So now the 70-year-old man, he's been denied his cheese by Hawaiian shirt Jackson. Then he sees the cheeseburger. He's like, oh, man, finally. Not only am I getting my cheese, but a little more protein. Perfect. Win-win. Oh, guess who comes by? Aloha Jones. Yes, eyeballs the cheeseburger. Now, 70-year-old man, he's had enough of this fall-to-roll. He goes, why don't you just go ahead of me because you're going to cut anyway. The 72-year-old pops him right in the noggin. Boom, drops him. Unbelievable. This is what happens when you're retired. You got a lot of time on your hands, and things just get rough and tumble. So here's my advice to you. One, don't wear a Hawaiian shirt and go to Costco. You're going to be viewed horribly. And two, let the old man have his cheese, which I think I should just put on a T-shirt. Let the old man have his cheese. All right, we got to do this, then we'll say goodbye.